Okay, so for follow up from yesterday, having slept on things, any comments, observations, questions?
Yes, I have one 2-part question and a second question. It has to do with the org chart in the school. You talked about a branch manager,
right?
Program director and an instructor. Is the branch manager the program director, or is the are we talking about three separate people?
Well, I guess the answer to that would be it depends on size and volume. What I always try to do in a multi-school environment is my threshold was 300 active, right? So over 300 active, I would go to three people, and under 300 active, it'd be two, right? So up to 300 active, it'd be basically program director and instructor. And then that designation of branch manager would be really whichever one of those two was in charge, right? And the reason for that designation was a couple of things. Tiger Shulman, last I knew, thinks about the same way. Bill Clark thinks about the same way. Is you really have the person who's in charge of the school from a management standpoint. I was talking about yesterday, you know, the June remodel and the Achilles heel of the Junry model was if you got two people in there that are equal, neither one of them is responsible, right? So you really have to have somebody who's responsible for the school. Now, in your case, as an owner-operator, I mean, that's you, right? So if you're running a single school, really the branch manager is the owner, you know, assuming you're not going to be an absentee owner, right? But as a single school, as an owner-operator, you're the branch manager. And now up to 300 active, really, you need one additional full-time person. And then over 300 active, it's useful to have a second. And another topic is the idea of multiple curriculums and multiple different programs and so forth. So that thing complicates it, right? So we want to talk about that a little bit. But I think, does that answer your question?
It does. Yeah. And the second question had to do with the qualification program.
Right.
Is that the same thing as orientation program, or is that like a 12-month or 18-month program? Or
qualification program.
That's what Paul called his basic program.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I mean, the way I think about it is you're enrolling them, you're bringing a new student into the school, and really their objective is to train to black belt and beyond, right? And, you know, if you're teaching a style that doesn't have rank, or if it, you know, if black belt is, you know, 32 years from now, you know, you have to think in practical terms of, you know, what an objective is, like getting your bachelor's degree, right? Like graduating from West Point, right? But when you bring a new student in, you're talking to them about your program, setting them to think about your program of you're coming into the school to become a black belt. And what we're going to do initially is enroll you for a trial enrollment to qualify to train to black belt. And so we're going to enroll you on a quarter of the way to black belt or a third of the way to black belt initially. And then over the next couple of weeks, the next couple of months, we'll be doing evaluations and qualifying to see if you qualify to train to that level. Does that make sense? And so, you know, if he was using the term qualification, I mean, that's pretty descriptive. I don't mind that at all. But that's the way you're thinking about it. And where people screw that up is they bring a new student in and all of the conversation about is we're going to start you on a 12-month, you know, blue belt program. Well, just the language, that both the subliminal communication and the overt communication sets them up to think I'm going to enroll and I'm going to be here for 12 months and at the end of 12 months there will be something next. Right? And it also sets them to think that whatever the belt level that they're enrolling for is like meaningful. Right? I mean, you don't go to, you know, what were their levels? You're a plebe and then you're something, then you're a cow. What was the middle one?
Yearling.
Yearling. You don't go to West Point in order to become a yearling. Right? And so, you know, if you're being accepted into West Point, they wouldn't say, you know, we're so excited to enroll you in West Point. We're going to admit you to get to your yearling year, and then before the yearling year starts, you can you know, you're going to go away, right? They're enrolling you to get your degree from West Point, right, and to graduate and move on, just as Harvard is enrolling you to get your bachelor's degree, whatever it might be. So you want to be very careful about the language during the enrollment conference so you don't set them up to think that your martial arts program is like a year thing. And if I do a year and then quit, that it meant something. Does that make sense? And sometimes we're hesitant to that because we want it to be like, oh, it was a big deal. They trained for a year and they learned all this stuff. But, you know, but it really isn't, right? I mean, if they didn't train for 3, 4, 5 years and really make it a lifestyle, then it really was just entertainment, right? And we all know that. I mean, you walk into people, you know, you're wearing your karate shirt, you run into somebody at the store and they say, oh, yeah, I did martial arts or I did karate, whatever. Well, you know, what level did you get to? Oh, I got to my gold belt or I got to my green belt. What do we all think? Well, dummy, why the hell did you drop out, right? And we also have no expectations that at this point they know anything, could do anything, could defend themselves, anything, right? So you've got to be careful not to set your students up to think that way to begin with. Does that make sense? Well, that's the two questions.
That was it.
Okay. Marty's usually good for, you know, I've got three questions. There's part A, part B, part C, right? Which is good. You know, it's very, very specific. Other follow-ups or questions or observations from yesterday or the day before?
You may be right going right to it. I don't know, but we're beginning addressing the leadership and the upgrade system today.
Right.
With that, and I know you've gone over the past, but we sitting here as
right.
well. But all of the school prep and the client prep
right.
leading up to that is my question. I'd like to get into the nuts and bolts of that kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely.
Every little detail of that.
Well, and that's 95% of the battle,
okay.
right? So we're going to do an awful lot of that today. Other questions or follow-ups?
I think that languaging is very succinct of moving from something that's entertaining and an activity into a lifestyle.
Right.
I know that supporting it on the front end is valuable. My question would be, what are key things that help that process of thinking? Not only the languaging and the languaging on the first meet, the languaging on the greeting, during the intro, during the initial enrollment process. But there's a few steps between that and then when they get their first letter in their packet, like more in the classroom, what's that psychology like during that orientation period before they do enroll? Like are there some key phrases that or mindsets that need to be done during that teaching aspect?
Before the initial enrollment or before the renewal?
Before the renewal.
Okay.
From initial enrollment to renewal.
You know, the best way I like to think about it is you're just constantly talking to them about really, again, whichever analogy you want to use, whether it's going to college or going to elementary school, right, is, you know, nobody talks to a first grader about graduating from third grade, right? I mean, it's all about you're going to go through, complete high school, and then go to college. And 4 years of college is probably more applicable to us initially. But you're talking to them about the whole process is to get to black belt and beyond. And we use exactly that terminology, and beyond. In a lot of cases, we're enrolling them to second degree black belt. But all of the language has to be wrapped around that, right? And then when you start looking at it, like one of the internal arguments that we have is I don't like diplomas except for black belt, right? So you have a belt graduation, and now they got a gold belt. Well, historically, we did diplomas for everything. And one of the things I got rid of years ago was a diploma for anything but first-degree black belt. And second degree black belt, third degree black belt. But my logic was why do we want to celebrate as if you've graduated your green belt, right? Is that's just like going from, you know, freshman year to sophomore year to junior year, right? And it doesn't mean we can't, you know, the elementary schools use the word continuation. Doesn't mean we can't celebrate the continuation, which is a good terminology. Doesn't mean we can't recognize achievement to date, but to actually you know, feel like there's this series of diplomas, and maybe black belt is a bigger one, but it's just the next series of diplomas, to me always seems counterproductive. Does that make sense? And so all the way through, the more you're having the communication about, well, this is step, you know, this step towards your black belt, here's what we're going to do to really accomplish the next step to your black belt. As long as all of that language becomes congruent in that, then you get them to think right about it. Does that make sense?
Yes.
And that's everything from what you call the enrollment. If you call it a purple belt course, that to me is, in a lot of these things are little bitty points, but then you accumulate them and they start to add up. Does that make sense? So instead of thinking about it like it's a purple belt course, it's a quarter of the way to black belt, right? It's the, you know, and again, what was Paul's terminology? It's the
qualification.
I mean, that, you know, that's great language. You know, it's the qualification period to see if you can train on to black belt or not. I mean, does that make sense? And so really, as you're again, your question was specifically as an instructor, and the instructor really needs to be. We're doing an exercise. Okay, everybody close your eyes, visualize. You know, your mission first is to get to your black belt and then train beyond black belt. And so let's all visualize that you're a black belt, look in the mirror, see yourself as having attained at that point. I mean, all of the exercises, anything you do, and this is true, adults, kids, whatever, it is all about that level of goal setting, sensory completeness of visualizing the goal, imagining that they're already there, but always, you know, future pacing, putting them in the future to see that level of accomplishment and get them excited. When I was at that EFC convention last year, and I hadn't been there to one of them for about 10 years, but there was one of the guys who was saying, well, you know, if you're really doing a good job and every class is really good, you don't need to do all this stupid future pacing and all this stuff. It really is just, you know, if every class is as good, well, that's complete horseshit. Because you can never have each class be good enough that I just can't wait to get there next time in the rush of everything else that goes on in my life, right? Is if the child and the parent or if the adult doesn't have a vision of what they're trying to accomplish, too many obstacles get in the way, right?
Is that true? At West Point, these guys are super highly motivated people, and yeah. They wouldn't need any, I mean, they went through hell just to be able to apply here and everything else, but do you think there's any reminders, visual reminders of what they should do in the future? And there's a bunch of statues of the guys that are famous out around. There's all, I mean, we could probably make a list of all the things that are visually in front of them and how they're imagining what's going to happen.
I bet we come up with 100 things.
And these are the most highly motivated. If there's any group of people, you can sit in a room and just like teach for a while, and then at the end just say, okay, you graduated. It would be those guys, but they still have that all over the place.
Yeah.
Mr. Oliver, I am referencing that. One of my biggest problems, that's not that I'm working on, but is very good qualified instructors doing an incredible job teaching martial arts, and they think that this is it.
Right.
And not referencing all of what you're speaking of right here in my regular classes and trying to sell something later on.
Right.
And then this is part of our program all the time, thinking that you want to be a black belt, you want to go to the next upgrade system and such. Mm-hmm. During the class, taking advantage of all that.
Right.
I actually have the biggest problem getting that in their heads that your martial arts quality is fantastic, but you suck at this, okay?
Yeah.
And it needs to be part of the program, so I need to train them to do that rather than just tell them.
I don't think that'd be the management language I would use.
No, well, with four people I could do that with, okay? So I don't do it with the others.
Yeah, well.
We're all friends here.
Marty?
So you don't give out, or you don't recommend giving out any kind of certificate or diploma for the ranks before black belt?
Well, you see, that's a small point, right? But I you know, just like philosophically, right? And again, like within the Mile High Karate organization, Jeff Smith and I have this argument. You know, like at Sterling School, they're doing a diploma for every rank. And why are they doing that? Well, mostly because he's been doing it for 40 years, right? So, but, you know, in Denver, I don't do any of that, right? And then what the pressure is always on the individual owner operators all like start creating them because they want them. And but I, from my standpoint, it's counterproductive. Now, that doesn't mean there's not medals and awards and certificates, but it's not like a diploma, right? I don't like you just got a green belt diploma. That's kind of like I just got a diploma for taking the midterm. You know, I mean, so what, right? And you don't want to devalue incremental accomplishment, but you don't want to put it on a pedestal either, because you got to keep the focus on the goal, right? I mean, again, West Point's a good example. It is a big deal for them to go, you know, to be a Cal, was there, you know, to be a junior. It's a big deal that you're now a junior, because you're now in more of a leadership role and there's an incremental step and so forth. But none of them go, wow, I'm done, right?
They don't have a party. They don't have, yeah.
So what do you give when they advance from belt to belt? What do you give besides the belt? And what is your graduation ceremony like? Or what do you recommend?
Well, what in practical terms, we're giving them all kinds of stuff, because we have like a reading club card, and they fill out the reading club card, they get a medal or some other award. Usually it's medals. If they do the self-discipline sheet, they get a medal. If they, you know, so we have all these different things that they can do to get medals. And maybe that's something we should try to do for next year's schedule, is maybe try to schedule one of the meetings at Sterling when they have a graduation. Because it'll be, if there's 200 people graduating, there's 500 different awards, right? Because they're getting, you know, an award for the book club card, book for the self-discipline card, all these different things, and publicly recognized for it. You know, my only point, and again, it's a small one, is that I think all of the language that you use counts, right? And the diploma they should be aiming for is to get their black belt, and then the second degree black belt, like a bachelor's degree, then a master's degree. It shouldn't be to get their gold belt or their green belt or their purple belt, right? And then when it comes to how you're presenting the program, it's always seemed extreme. I mean, we used to present it as, you know, we have a purple belt program and we have a blue belt program. Well, why would I have a blue belt program? You don't want anybody to ever get to blue belt and they're done, right? But what I want is again, that language, a qualification or a trial or an evaluation program that sees if we'll allow them to train to black belt and beyond, right? And all of that language is super important for setting it up, right? And again, Eric, this goes to the heart of where did Eric and I end up? Oh, over there. This goes to the heart of having anemic results on the upgrade, is it's all about how you set them up to think about it on the way in, right? If the upgrade is I'm trying to sell you something more when this was adequate, you know, it's not that big a deal. On the other hand, if you enrolled under the premise that we're just going to evaluate you and see if you're really a good fit for this school long term, and now we've approved you, and in your case, you know, to train to purple belt, or that's your 3-4 year program, right? So to train to purple belt on the route to black belt, and your black belt's the equivalent of, for most people in here, second or third degree black belt. So, you know, and when we're doing upgrades, we're enrolling them to second degree black belt, which is again kind of like your equivalent of black belt. So the more you set them to think about that long term from the first interaction, right? So the first time they walk in, you're setting them to think about that's the outcome and that's the mission of the program. Then it'll be natural for everybody not only to want to, but be focused on that right away, right? But where we fall short is we just get them going on something that they're perfectly happy with, and then we try to sell them something additional, and we're dangling like you get to do this and this. Well, but I'm already enjoying this, and it's already complicated enough for me, and I don't need to overcomplicate it. You know, that's what goes on in their mind. Rather than, well, yeah, I really like you guys, and I love this, and I'd really like to really master it and accomplish it. is it okay for me to go ahead and train to a higher level? See that? See the complete difference in psychology? Did that answer?
No, we
didn't address your staff thing.
Not
you guys are complete morons. That what was your language? You completely suck at.
Well, they teach great martial arts, and I'm really proud of that. But
well, let's
getting to adjust the fact that implementing all these lessons into their lessons and that kind of thing to get the message across. Not like, okay, my physical class is over. Now, by the way, we have the Black Belt Leadership Program, so we should be thinking like this. That doesn't cut it. Okay, so. I mean, I'm in the process of doing what you're speaking of because I've been with you a while, but that's one of my major goals is to get through this part of it, which is working well.
What you've got to do with the staff is you've always got to pull it back and put it in their mind as a student, right? And so many times when they go from student to staff, then you're talking to them in like business language.
Right.
And they're consciously or subconsciously resisting the business language because they're thinking, well, I'm a martial artist. I don't want to be pitching them, selling them, whatever that is, right? And it's the mistake that we make. It's not the mistake on their part, right? Is you've got to be constantly reminding them. Okay, let's think about why you trained in martial arts. Let's go back to when you were a white belt. Let's go back to when you were a beginner. Now, let's think about what you've accomplished in the process. And, you know, that whole story of, you know, go back to the day you started and if I gave you $1 million, right? You essentially want to be doing that with them every week, right? Is you want to be reminding them. And one of the ways you remind them is you're constantly doing student success stories, right? So you're constantly looking for, you know, the kid who has cerebral palsy who got his black belt, or the woman who was physically abused, or one thing by her husband, and now she's, you know, all those kind of stories. You're constantly looking for all those kind of stories to keep it from becoming about the money and keep it focused on the outcome. Does that make sense?
It does.
And then as you're looking for discussing, anchoring in all of those kind of stories about what the outcome is your conversation. See, none of that outcome is about, oh my goodness, Joe can kick now at 90 degrees. See, they're not about physical, are they? They're all about personal, developmental. They're about, you know, creating confidence, bringing people out of their shell. And it's okay to have the stories about so-and-so just went to the tournament and they won grand champion. I mean, that's okay. But it's not nearly as empowering as those other stories, right? And then as you're constantly internally talking about that, recognizing it, celebrating that kind of impact on human beings, is you want to be constantly relating it to why is it that training with us has that kind of impact on people mentally, emotionally, psychologically? Well, it's because of these things, right? And so wouldn't it be possible that if we're achieving that already automatically for some portion, couldn't we broaden that? Couldn't we have higher levels of success? Couldn't we teach that more specifically and directly, have it be overt rather than almost subliminal, right? And so do you see the movement with the staff mindset? So they start to see, well, that really is what we're teaching. And that they can get so focused on it's like this that they miss that is about the emotional content. It's about focus. It's about feeling good about myself. It's about having the physicality affect my mental state. It's about being healthier, right? So that they miss how it all is interacting on a holistic basis. And so the more you're starting with outcomes, starting with success stories, anchoring them back to why they did this to begin with, what they were proud of accomplishing, and then you say, well, really, if we're trying to develop a higher level of leadership, and that's what this program is all about anyway, could we do it faster, quicker, more successfully, with greater efficacy? Well, what do you mean? Well, what if we were teaching it like this as well as what we've been doing? What if we were adding this as a stronger emotional component? Hey, Greg, would we be better off to close off this circle and pull it in? It's kind of a long room.
I can hear down here, but yeah, probably would be better.
I mean, because we got one, two, three tables across. We could do three tables across there, and we're not quite as long. You think?
Go back to a classroom setting. So we do three.
Well, no, I'm just thinking we just close off the loop. So we take, if we took the two tables at this end and one table at that end and pulled it across, then it at least shortens up the distance a little bit. That might help a little bit. Eric, can you hear me okay? Okay. It's not like I haven't projected to big classes a few times over 40 years, but... But is this making sense?
Yeah, you know, it makes me feel good because my last meeting was like that.
Oh, good,
it was
good.
Exactly like that. And
good.
Got them to build the team as you do with
right,
us.
Right.
Together.
Yeah.
And see the light, like, oh, okay, this is how your psychic has to be 100,000 times
right.
mastered. So does their martial arts character development training.
Exactly.
So it must be part of the class. Okay?
Yeah.
So, and I want your input for this, how to make it better. And
yeah.
It's been working.
Yeah. See, I really think, and I've been as guilty of it over the years as anybody, but you have a tendency to bring your staff together, and all of a sudden it's about dollars and cents and numbers and upgrades, and it loses the human component, right? And it also, and I think for probably some of us too, but, I mean, the mission is the people, and the secondary outcome is we make a good living. Right.
I always tell them, I mean, I expect high-end quality martial arts
yeah.
training, but let's get the most out of that high-end
right.
quality martial arts training.
Yeah.
That's a given. I mean, that's our reputation.
Yeah. But, I mean, even at, like, we had our big black belt retreat a couple weeks ago. But at the black belt retreat, and this is not staff, this is, you know, like all the black belts are getting in a room and they're talking about the new candidates and one thing or another. 75% of the conversation is about how much more confident they are and how much more disciplined they are and how they rose to the occasion, or it's about the converse of character flaws that we're trying to fix. And of course you're talking about, you know, he really needs to be a little bit more flexible and we need to, you know, she was huffing and puffing out there, you know, got the conditioning for, you know, for this level. But most of it is about those other components, right? And it's what, and again, Carol, we've had that conversation and Al about the Krav thing forever, is, see, most of defending yourself isn't knowing how to do an elbow, it's having the mental state to be composed in the situation, right? And if we don't articulate that with the staff and move them to that transition, they all tend to go to the easiest common denominator, which is I get them to do this real well.
It's easier to teach martial arts than all that other stuff, okay? You know?
But it is martial arts. Those other things are martial arts.
Yeah,
arts techniques, and I hear you.
You jumped
physical,
in.
You know, the physical versus the mental. There's all those things are far. I mean, isn't it?
I know what you're saying, though. Even back in the traditional days, it was philosophical anyways. We're not really changing anything.
See, there's like something, a phrase I use with parents, and sometimes I remember a parent came in and said, "Well, go play karate now to her kid, right?" And it made me want to puke because
exactly.
now I'm like, this is not, I'm not, that's not the attitude she should have. I wasn't mad at her. I was just like, I haven't done my job that she's having that attitude. So we started saying, we use karate with everybody. So when the class, sometimes an instructor say, "Who do you use your karate on?" And the answer for the kids is nobody. You know, well, if you're never going to use your martial arts ever in your life, why would they want to pay you $300 a month or $500 a month for it? If you're never going to use it. Or it's only going to be useful in the small possible case where maybe you're going to get in a fight, which most of those kids are not going to get in a real bad fight, like a dangerous, you know, life-threatening fight. So where should they use it? They should use it everywhere. So our phrase is, we use this phrase for self-defense. Master Oliver and I were talking about the distinction between bullying and fighting, and it's the decision where you need to use force. And then it gets into discussions of levels of force. But we use with the kids is, who do you hit? And they hit somebody who's trying to hurt them. So only somebody's trying to hurt them. So we try to train the kids that. Well, who do you use your karate on? Everybody. We use our karate on everybody. Well, how about your teachers? We say yes, sir, and yes, ma'am to our teachers. Or how about your parents? We show respect to our parents. That's how we use our martial arts with our parents. We use, and we tell the parents, we make sure the parents understand that. We tell you, we're going to tell your kid to use your karate on everybody. They're like, oh!
Right.
You know? But you have to explain that, because if you don't make it kind of really straightforward and abrupt, which I think you're probably good at, you'll be comfortable with that, right? No, but I mean, I think we need to make it almost shocking. If you don't, then they don't get it. Because they still, okay, yeah, I know you use your karate on everybody, but don't use your karate on everybody.
Right.
You know?
I understand exactly what you're speaking of. Those lessons within are vital, and it's part of the martial arts training on a regular basis. We all do it anyway. We just need to get the credit for it, actually.
Right.
I think what Master Oliver said, and I know some other people have said this before, there's not a difference between this stuff. And there's not a difference between the business part of it. I mean, if you want to talk about the olden days, and I wasn't around 1,000 years ago, but I'm sure the guys who were teaching martial arts, somebody gave them a cow or a pig or something. I mean, they didn't do it for free. It wasn't supposed to be free. You know, people got support for their efforts. You know, so none of this business stuff is separate from what we do. So I agree with everything you're saying. I also, at some point, and with the staff, if they're just like, oh, I just want to be a martial artist, and I don't want to sell, or I don't want this. It's like, you know, it's really them being afraid, them having an excuse for not wanting to have to be rejected. They just want to stand up in front of a class and have everybody bow to them and say yes, sir, and stuff. And they don't really want to be martial artists, because martial artists should be willing to take the stress of whatever's going to happen in real life. It's not that big a deal if you stand up in front of people that I've already trained and you tell them to kick and punch. That's not really teaching a martial. That's not anything difficult.
I feel that we're way past that with you know, going on 4 years here with all of you. I've implemented most of that. But I'm trying to take it to such another extreme level from the get-go as we're speaking.
Well, and what he said, because I was going to jump in and say exactly the same thing, is it's kind of like having the purple belt course. Is the language you're using in the school and with the staff has to be congruent with it sets them to think right about it, right? And so when you said they're just teaching martial arts, well, I would be okay with saying they're just teaching the athletic component of what we do. They're just teaching the physical movement. But the teaching martial arts is the all-encompassing, right? And so it's all the language you use in the school has to reflect that, right? That it's about focus, and it's about adrenal control, and it's about stress management, and it's about human interaction, and it's about all those things. Commissioner Carrick trained with Peter Urban. Peter Urban wrote a great book in the 60s, I think called The Dojo, and it was all about the same thing. And then you have Funakoshi's book, Karate Do, which was written, I think, in the 60s also, maybe a little earlier. Karate Do Way of Life. I mean, it was the same principles in that. And Stephen Hayes and I were having this kind of, in fact, it was with the email newsletter. I was reading a book at the time. What the hell was it called? But it was about the samurai. But, I mean, in ancient Japan, martial arts were for the rich. It wasn't for every man. It was, they were teaching the wealthy. And so, you know, it doesn't matter whether you're talking about Japan 300 years ago or if you're talking about the 50s or talking about the 60s. The personal development aspect was the origins of this. And the financial aspects, you know, it goes hand in hand. And, again, somehow, we end up in this weird artist mentality, and of course, artists have the same problem, right? I mean, do you want to be starving artist, or do you want to be, one of the guys who people are actually looking at their art, right? I'd rather much better be Spielberg. You know, if I'm going to be an artist, I'd rather be Spielberg than the guy who's trying to, you know, piece together the film that nobody sees, right? So, So we're really no different than that. But you've got to make sure all the language is congruent. And what happens is if you've got guys who are just focusing on just the physicality, they're not very good instructors.
I'm systemizing everything so that doesn't happen anyway. And that's kind of, we're right in exactly where I want to be, so it's really perfect for me here.
I had the other problem where somebody I hired maybe from externally that was a really good person, they were doing sales, and they didn't really want to do martial arts, and I never had good luck with that. So I've hired people out off the street that were, you know, somebody I met that wanted to work, and I hired them. I said, but you got to train with us. So we still train them. And a few of them have gotten their black belt and been with me for many years, and they're really excited. That's almost a bigger success story than the ones that wanted to do it, and then I kind of turned it into being able to be a staff member. But it's you got to do both. I mean, I just don't see a disconnect. For me, there's no disconnect. There's no disconnect between having our meetings here and being a better martial arts instructor when we go home, you know, even if we're not doing physical training.
I agree 100%. You know, I'll put it to you this way. It's easier for them not to worry about anything else. It's easier to smash and kick and punch and hurt and go, yahoo, I'm sweating, I have a good workout. But as you're saying, both of you are saying, those lessons should be integrated within every technique. It takes focus to drive an elbow and not really break his jaw, but it takes focus to drive an elbow and break their jaw if it's necessary. So let's practice our focus, our commitment, our degree of character and respect with one another. That all should be implemented during every class. And that alone is where I'm having troubles getting those words out of their mouth.
They don't do it, just break their jaw.
Exactly. I want to systemize it, so this is the way it's done.
Well, you know, and again, I mean, we're here at West Point, right? All of the intramural sports, and obviously some of it is designed for athleticism and to make sure they're clear thinking and so forth. But, I mean, Don Sutherland talks about when he was teaching, you know, Tang Soo-do here at West Point, is, you know, the officers would come by and say, now you realize we don't really care about them learning how to do a round kick. We care about them developing leadership skills and focus. And this is about the personal development aspect, right? And, you know, and on the tour, she was saying, I forget who it was. It wasn't Eisenhower, whoever.
MacArthur,
who had identified the fitness component of good officers. And, of course, what they were identifying is the physical fitness in a war environment or a comparable environment certainly gives increased stamina and the capacity to do that and so forth, but it also gives better mental clarity, right? And you can't separate one from the other, right? There's no such thing as them being massively out of shape in one thing or another and having the ability to have that level of mental clarity under stress, right? So you've got to be very congruent in that kind of conversation. And again, it's easy.
I agree 100%. Yeah. I think repeating it like you're repeating martial arts kicking and striking lessons alone without the words is the only way that I can make it a regular thing is train them that way, and that's the only way it's going to be done.
Right.
And that's where I'm going with this because telling them isn't cutting it.
Yeah.
It'd be like telling them to do their kata 20 times this way. I showed you once, now go do it 500 times.
Right.
It's not working, so.
Well, that's a good example. Everything that we want them to do, we should probably, we're instructors, and if we were teaching them a form, we teach them a bunch of times. And, you know, sometimes we tell them to clean the school, and we're pissed off they don't, we told them once, and we were pissed off they didn't do it right. It's not going to work that way. It's the same thing. So, you know, to me, that's just a lesson. It's not that part of this stuff's that much different.
Yeah.
You just ask, do we have a curriculum for the sales curriculum? We have a rotation. We have a plan. Same as we do with the martial arts. In our case, it's on the same cycle.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's what I'm picking up more than anything is let's get everything structured in. And this is the way it's done. Every element, this is the way it's done. And I'm working on that right now diligently.
Right. Good. Any other follow-up from yesterday?
I just wanted some more advice on, I'm going to try to develop an elite leadership club. Mm-hmm. I have my master's, I have my leadership, and now I want to take it a step further. And so I'm trying to figure out, well, what will I give them? Because I feel like I've given my leadership club just about everything. So right. I'm trying to get some ideas maybe on that.
Okay, sure. And we talked about that last night, so we'll address that as we go. Let's do that within the context of the upgrade blitz and so forth. The a couple of other things before we go thoroughly into this. You know, Master Moody and I were talking at breakfast this morning, and we come across an awful lot of... They never showed up with my pens, did they? Master Moody, I asked her an hour ago.
No, they're actually the other boards in the other room. I'll just give it to
you. Oh, is that it? Okay. Perfect. But we come across a lot of schools, and some of you are still kind of in this situation where somebody, let's say, has 100 students, and now they think that the way to grow their school is to add a different curriculum. And then they add a different curriculum, and they add a different curriculum, right? And it's been a, you know, kind of a thing within the industry the last 4 or 5 years, right? And certainly NAPNA was doing this as well. You know, I de-emphasized and phased out all that stuff. But, you know, NAPNA before was selling a Tai Chi program and I don't know, however many other different types of things. And Maya is doing it, and it seems like everybody's doing it. But I very rarely... Oh.
Everybody might want to have the stuff from yesterday, too.
Yeah, absolutely. Didn't dawn on me to go look in the Hap Arnold room and see if it was still there. But how many in the room right now have more than one thing that you're teaching? Okay. So, and... Jan, in your case, is it transport after school care plus the martial arts, or is there more than that?
I have more than that, but not very successfully.
Right.
It's type of disaster. I have MMA, I have Zumba, I have yoga, and none of them are doing very well. So I probably should just wipe them all out. But
kill them all, yeah. Okay. If you don't mind, we'll use you as an example.
Bad example.
Well, okay, so...
Not too bad.
It may hurt, but
it's already
designed to make you more money. So you've got MMA, and you've got Zumba, and what else do you have?
Well, yoga off and on.
Yoga, and you're a Tang Soo stylist, so your primary thing is a Tang Soo school, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have transport after school care.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, how much revenue per month are you doing on MMA?
Virtually nothing. We call it grappling. We're making like $200 a month. What I've done is I've let all my upgrade students take that class because I have not gotten outside students into that class. Very few. I make virtually nothing.
Okay. So
I have like two paying students, two maybe.
Okay. So there's $300 a month, more or less, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. How about Zumba?
I make... not very much, maybe a couple hundred a month. I split whatever comes in with the Zumba teacher, so.
Okay, and then yoga?
Nothing. I was paying the lady more so I could have private lessons. I like it, so we do it.
With the Zumba teacher is that they're supposed to market and fill the school in that spot? Or are you responsible also for marketing?
No. What happened was I wanted yoga. The Zumba teacher came to me, and I said, sure, whatever we do, we'll split it 50-50. So it's no work on my part. It's no extra work.
Well, so you
except
don't
for mat space.
Well, it is work, though, because you got to make sure there's a cost.
Collect the money and mat space.
And opportunity cost of not using the mat space for something else.
Yes.
Let's perhaps differentiate between two scenarios. Scenario number one is student who's into teaching yoga says, are you doing anything in the school Tuesday, Thursday at 10 a.m.? No. Would it be okay if I came in and ran my yoga class with 10 students in the facility? See, you know, that's a scenario where I have no marketing responsibility, truthfully, I have no profit motive other than if they're going to pay me rent to use it, that's fine. Versus, I'm now thinking of this as another profit center, right? And, you know, on a purely business intellectual basis, I could care less if, you know, somebody has a little church class coming in on Sunday morning using the school while I'm home in bed, and I don't have to be there, and I don't have to think about it, and there's nothing that can get stolen, and it's just somebody who I trust has a key. I don't care about that, right? What I do care about is any time we're investing even a little bit of mental energy into yet one more thing, right? And does everybody understand what I mean by the difference in that? And so if I've got a Tang Soo Do school, and let's say that prime on the Tang Soo Do school is 300 students, million a year, right? We walk through those numbers Friday, I guess, right? So if my prime on the Tang Soo Do school is, let's get the 300 students to a million a year. The question is this, and this going to get me closer to that, or is it going to get me further away, right? And in almost all cases, it's further away. And, I mean, there's rare exceptions to this, but again, and Greg, you and I have been having that conversation wherever you're at now about Zumba, cardio, kickboxing, and basically Taekwondo, right? But when you start doing all these different things, is it just distracts your energy, right? And again, in most cases, it's whatever you're best at. So if you're really good at and love Tang Soo Do, well, that's what you could do with Tang Soo Do, right? And then the question is does this other stuff add or detract from it, right? And so let's take a different example. Who else has multiple curriculums? What all are you running?
Our main program is Taekwondo.
Okay.
We teach a sword class. We teach Aikido and Gracie Jiu-Jitsu.
Okay. What's your logic in teaching Aikido and Taekwondo?
You do the bully-proof program there?
Yes, that's part of the Gracie Jiu-Jitsu.
But I thought you sold that as a separate item.
Well, it's separate in that it's kids and then there's adults Gracie Jiu-Jitsu.
Okay.
So that's
the way you've got it set up, I call that an additional one.
Okay.
Because you're trying to get the kids in that one. It's kind of what you're trying to market, right?
Yes.
And what's the difference between Hapkido and Taekwondo?
Taekwondo, it's I should say Hapkido that has none of the forms.
No, I that. But why do you have two different programs that are?
All of those programs besides the Jiu-Jitsu were already part of the school when I purchased it from my instructor.
Okay.
So we've had students in them, so we kept those programs there, mainly because of that reason.
What is it you want to teach?
I personally teach the Taekwondo and the Jiu-Jitsu.
Okay, so that and that. See, and what percentage of your revenue is split up among those things?
I'd say 90% in the Taekwondo.
Okay.
And the other 10% is divided up against with the other programs.
Everything else.
Everything else.
I mean, that one's obvious on the face of it, right? What do? You kill everything.
Scrub everything else. Or put it all into your main.
Well, program. Yeah, I mean, in this case, right? Because you just had the Taekwondo program, then you have the upgrade, and now in the upgrade, they get to learn sword, and they get to learn the Hapkido crap that you don't do in Taekwondo.
That's what we're doing.
That's what we're doing now. Right? But you don't enroll new people into the program separately. Nor do you have any reason to run separate classes, right? So I see this a lot. I have the upgrade, and now I can come to the sword classes. Well, why not just have the sword classes be one of the modules, right? So you're doing a rotating curriculum anyway. you can have a module where you teach sword, and you can have a module. And the see, the only exception to this, and Eric, you're always my best reference point for this, so chip in here. I hate to see Taekwondo guys try to be grapplers. Okay? And being a Taekwondo guy, I can, you know, I can say this, right? Is, and you may be a black belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, for all I know, but there's an awful lot of Taekwondo guys who are horrible at grappling. And then all of a sudden, when all this stuff started coming in, they went and did a couple seminars, and they all of a sudden they teach grappling, right? And the and then what happens, from my experience, if you're running a kid's family program, and you brought a bunch of kids and families into Taekwondo, and then you try to force grappling on them, there's some portion of them that dislike it to the point that you almost force them to drop out. Right? Now, you know, all the moms should know at least enough to get somebody off of them, and they should know, you know, they should know a little bit to, you know, legitimately saying we're teaching martial arts, right? And all the kids should know a little bit. But if you force that as part of the curriculum, what I've done when I force that as part of the curriculum is I pushed a lot of them out the door, because there were a lot of them that really liked stand up but they didn't want to grapple. And does the dynamic go the other way, or are there grapplers who just don't like stand-up? It really doesn't go the other way, does it?
No, it's yeah.
Does it?
People like.
They like what they like. Yeah.
I think it does go the other way, because I had some friends that did jiu-jitsu, and I asked them if they they do any fighting stand-up. And what was really interesting is Mike Swain, right? You know, he's the
yeah. Like, Mike's a great guy.
And I talked to him, and he taught a ground fighting class in the LRT training I took. And I said to him, I said, well, you know, since you're an expert at fighting on the ground, that's what you do mostly. He goes, yeah. And I said, well, so what would you advise somebody if they were in a street fight and the guy's standing up and you're going to fight? He goes, oh, I'd never go to the ground. He was like, I'd make sure I fought standing up, you know. He's like, because I don't want to go to the ground and have all these objects around and all this stuff. I would never do that. And this was Mike, you know, who's really pretty well respected.
So, Olympian judo guy.
You know, and he's like, that's what he does. But yeah. And that's not to devalue anything. It's just that I think
hey guys,
some
why don't we
like
close out the background?
That's,
what's that?
Yeah, let's
see if the door will move.
Oh, man, I feel bad. He just grabbed it.
Yeah, this was him closing the door.
Yeah. They oiled it last night.
Is that it? Okay. Okay. You just loosened it up for him.
Yeah, I did. That was it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's true. Is that some people like grappling, they don't like.
Yeah, so
I want to hear what Eric has to say. I see him over there.
He had already just agreed with that.
Yeah, but I mean, if you have brothers and they beat you up on the ground every day, you're real comfortable with it.
Yeah.
My daughter, 13, was like, yeah, Dad, I'm not rolling around on the ground with a bunch of guys anymore. I mean, and then I have other girls that like it. So, then it's like, some of us are wired different than others. And then you try to cross over. It's just like academics, right? I may not like math, but I do enough math to support my career inside of something else. And I have to have the discipline to do that. But, you know, if you just force me to do math all day, I may just quit.
So was it an offered with a choice, or?
Yeah, I mean, it's always about this.
I didn't make it to your school.
What you want to accomplish, right? I mean, where do you want to be, and how do you get there? And for some people, you know, just visiting with some parents, they have two children here at West Point, and the third son is looking at here, Stanford, and he wants to go to Stanford. The path he wants to take doesn't include this level of self-discipline. And it's just different than the other two kids in his family. And he was distinguishing that for the other two, that discipline is important to what they want to achieve in their life. For him, Stanford has the attributes that he wants to achieve, and so he gets to choose. I think it's the same thing.
Yeah, that's a really good description. But, I mean, is this making sense? Somebody else, let's take an example, who's doing two or three different things. Yes.
When there was a period of time when, I don't know why my husband's not speaking up, but we run a judo program.
Separate.
Yeah.
Aikido separate, Taekwondo separate. You get almost three different types of personalities.
Yeah.
Your judo, your wrestler.
Judo wants to be a national world champion. The karate guy wants to be all-rounded. He wants to know martial arts. But he also wants to be more business. Aikido's the intellect.
Yeah.
They're the intellect. They're self-contained. The judo guy, the rough kind of guy, wants to be with the champ. And the Taekwondo people want to be, I guess, more normal. I don't know. Somehow.
Right.
They're a little more well-rounded.
Yeah.
It's more of a mainstream activity than the guys that do Aikido or Judo.
Well, I had a friend that was an Aikido master at some level. And he was a friend of mine because he was an online internet marketer, guru, slash technical guy. And I built up a relationship, and then when he found out what I did, all of a sudden, he wanted me to be giving him free consulting on the Aikido school he had on the site, right? And he was making a lot of money on the internet stuff, but he had the Aikido school. And, you know, my first conversation is, well, why the hell are you running an Aikido school if you're doing all this other stuff, right? And it was kind of like your yoga answer, you know, well, I just want to do it myself. So, but then he was wanting to market, he was wanting to buy black and white advertisement in the alternate newspaper, which in Denver is called Westward, and he was giving me this list of stuff, and I took a few hours with him. I said, "Well, who are your existing students?" And my conclusion was, "Why don't you just go to the University of Denver, University of Colorado, you know, go through all the professors. I mean, because that's what you have already, right? You have all these academic eggheads who are in your program. Why would you advertise to the great unwashed masses if your students are going to be, if nine out of 12 of his students were PhDs, mostly in some weird esoteric thing. It's like, if that's your student body, just go get all the other eggheads and offer it to them, and don't try it. I mean, you're beating head against the wall to do anything else. I mean, just to, you know, go back to your story of that. But
Master Oliver, you guys now don't do that separately. You
sell it. They're just a time of those the main thing, but these other things are just awkward things that we can help to upgrade people and give a little more variety.
The other difference that Chief Master Linton's saying here is, like, if you're offering, if you're trying to teach Zumba, or you took a weekend Krav class, and now you're trying to teach Krav, or you're doing that, he's an expert. He's, what are you in Aikido, sir?
I don't do Aikido. Aikido,
I'm sorry, sir.
I've taught in Japan 15 years, I'm the founder, so that's why I came.
Like the founder of Aikido.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was the founder. He taught for the founder of Aikido.
Right.
Like,
we got to meet the founder. So he's 33.
Yeah, you want to hear stories from him about all this stuff. I mean, he's an expert at all those things. So for him to teach those would make some sense. But you don't do that now because it takes away from the focus of the business, right? Yeah.
Right.
And it's hard to market. So if you're going to market Taekwondo, and you were going to try to market Aikido, and you were going to try to market Judo, you'd have to market to three different groups. And we see a lot of people where their postcards, they have a postcard, and they have, like, Taekwondo and like Krav Maga and like hip, it's like you're marketing to different people, and it takes away, it dilutes everything that you're doing.
Yeah, yeah. And if you look at all of this stuff, see, where the fallacy is, I think, in almost all cases, is if I have to go create a marketing funnel in order to feed a Taekwondo program, and then I create a different marketing funnel to feed a program on teaching sword, a different marketing funnel for jujitsu, a different marketing program for anti-bullying with jujitsu, and a different program, marketing program for Aikido, which frankly, I don't know how you create a separate program from Taekwondo or Aikido. I mean, they're the same damn thing, more or less, right? So if you have a marketing activity going in and you're teaching Taekwondo and Aikido, essentially, I guess you're giving them a choice of, do you want to do Taekwondo or Aikido? They don't know the difference coming in. So then you're just artificially dividing up where they go, right? Does that make sense? And
See, where it ends up being a lot of times is I do an adult women's program and do it as like a cardio program. And then I do an adult men's program of some sort. And then I do a kids program, and I keep them all separate. And at some point, I guess that's fine, but if...
What you do now is we use these different... We give those, you know, we instead of trying to get them all come in and separate them,
right.
We take all these least short activities out there and to get them back into one main program.
But it's all integrated, so there's...
It's all integrated, yeah. You go out and you talk to some type of like keto or something just to get them into the Taekwondo as the foundation, and we got everybody on the same page and marketing to the athlete to the same group.
So if you went, if you went to the PhD AK guys at the university and taught Aikido, and that was really attractive to them, you try to pull them into your Taekwondo funnel. And if you went to the judo guys, and then you'd say, well, you know, now you pull into our martial arts. You don't have to call it Taekwondo. You call it martial arts. That's the third distraction I was going to mention, Master Oliver, is sometimes people are going to take like a Krav class or a something class or something, whatever you want to call it, and they think the argument is if they do cardio kickboxing or they do something, that it's going to funnel them into your school, like it like using it as a marketing activity.
It's the argument of I bring in a bunch of women who do cardio kickboxing and now they'll do Taekwondo. So I'm using that as a lost leader to get them into the other thing. Well, you get some. I mean, if you have that excuse, you validate your excuse because you get some, but you don't get a lot. And you could have gotten more without that intermediate step, right? Without doing that piece of it as a distraction.
And maybe have a lot less brain damage and have to hire another instructor and have to perform your schedule and have to do this.
But it seems like if you're going to try to generalize this for everybody's benefit and take what Eric was saying a minute ago and what I was saying a minute ago, if you're running a Taekwondo program or a Shotokan program and something like that, and if you want to add additional stuff, and my argument would be is you add additional stuff because that's what the students want to learn. Usually it goes the opposite way. You add additional crap because you're out learning additional crap and now you want to teach it to them, right? Mm-hmm. Now, that's the wrong way to go about it, okay? Most of the additional stuff that we've added to the school over the years wasn't what I was personally interested in. It's what we made a decision would be useful for the students, right? So, I mean, that's the first statement. Now, having said that, most of you are still going to do it the opposite way. You're going to be the martial artist. Dave Kovar is the worst guy in the world about this. He goes and learns some other thing because he just likes to go learn some other thing, and then he tries to justify how to put it in the curriculum. Mm-hmm. But given that a lot of you are going to do it that way anyway, when you add stuff to the curriculum, you've got to be thinking, is this something that essentially 100% of your students would be excited to learn, or is this something that's niched enough that some of them are going to love it, some of them are going to hate it, right? And if it's niched enough that some are going to love it, some of them are going to hate it, that's the rationale for adding a separate class that's like the grappling class, right? So it's optional to come to that. But if it's something that they're essentially all going to like, that's the logic for it's something to add to the upgrade program that integrates. Does that make sense? So, you know, two good examples. If I'm a Taekwondo, Shotokan, whatever, stylist, and now I want to do Gracie Jiu-Jitsu or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu or some version of grappling, well, that's something that it's a grappling class that's optional. It's not an obligatory, right? Because some are going to love it, some are going to hate it. So, and again, I've done it in the past where it was obligatory and I just managed to, you know, drop out a bunch of the black belts because I hated it, right? And if I'm a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu school, would you say the Muay Thai or the stand-up generally is the thing that's that polarizing?
You mean
Well, yeah, if I was good, do I want to make it obligatory or do I want to make it optional?
Optional.
Optional, right? So it goes exactly in the reverse, too. So if I'm a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu school and I want to have, whether we call it Muay Thai or whatever we call it, if I want to have a stand-up class, you make that a class that's stand-up that they optionally can take. You don't make that now be mandatory, right, as part of the curriculum. Because, again, you don't want to add a piece of curriculum that's designed to force some of them to quit,
right?
And that, to me, that was Chuck Norris's mistake with their organization is, you know, he brought in Carlos Machado, and they have parallel rank in jiu-jitsu with the higher-level black belts. So you once you're into second-degree black belt, there's parallel ranks. And if I remember correctly, it was by the time you're a third-degree black belt, you had to be a purple belt in jiu-jitsu, and by the time you're like a fifth degree, you had to be a black belt. But the people that they had already, a good portion of them just didn't want to grapple, right? So it becomes polarizing, right? But then you have all this other stuff, right? So, you know, like what we see here. So let's say I'm a Taekwondo school, and now I have a sword class, a sword curriculum, a Hapkido curriculum. Well, those are things that just become integrated up here, right? So anytime, and again, we were kind of a root American Taekwondo school, but we added, you know, everything from samurai sword to nunchucks to kamas to sais to eskrima. But none of those were things that anybody's going to say, ooh, I don't like to do it. My only exception to that reaction was I don't want any live blades ever, right? So anytime that it's like something that cuts, we're using a fake one, right? We're not going to be, you know, live blades even not sharpened because I don't want mom sitting over there going, oh, you're teaching my daughter to knife fight, right? I mean, that has the wrong reaction. But all that stuff is just fine. They enjoy it. You don't flush anybody out with that. And some of it, like the Eskrima, is so much fun that they, you know, really want to get into the upgrade level because, oh, that I really want to do that, right? So Chucks is like that. You know, Eskrima is like that. I'm not sure that, you know, Kamas or Sais are. They're kind of damn boring weapons to learn, but you get the idea, right? So it's the things that look exciting become part of the upgrade. But the fallacy is to have a whole bunch of different, see, pretty much everybody in the room, and I'll overgeneralize, but pretty much everybody in the room on a scale of 1 to 10 on their physical martial art is a 9 or 10. Would everybody agree with that? And pretty much everybody in the room on a marketing genius scale is a 2 or 3, right? So if I'm a 2 or 3 on the marketing, and now instead of having one thing to market, I have 6 things to market, I really shot myself in the foot, right? Because it doesn't work this way. It doesn't work, I'm mediocre at marketing Taekwondo, so now if I can be mediocre at marketing Taekwondo, sword, Hapkido, and Jiu-Jitsu, things go better, right? See, all of a sudden, if you split your focus 5 different ways, you know, you're just 1/5 as good at any one of those things.
Not to mention the monetary end of it.
Well, yeah, well, but that's the that's not only the marketing fallacy, it's the complication above, right? And certainly, like with any of this stuff, see, my argument with Zumba is this. See, Zumba has done a marvelous job of being trendy and of branding itself in one thing or another. The problem is they've exercised zero control over the business side of it, right? So I texted Greg one time. I'm standing in Starbucks and there's a poster that said free Zumba, you know, in the church basement. Anytime you're trying to teach something like Zumba that you can go to the church or the community center and get for free, you know, at least if you're going to teach whatever the hell Zumba is, change the name and don't use their trademark, right? And then make up some other name and charge, you know, more for it, right? I think the other fallacy is always taking all this stuff and deciding that there's a component that has to be cheap, right? So if I've got a Taekwondo program and a cardio kickboxing program,
I'll see people who say, well, my Taekwondo program is $200 a month, my cardio kickboxing is $79 a month, and we have 10 lesson punch cards. And so now what they do is they guarantee that the cardio kickboxing is never going to make any money, right? And is it true that cardio kickboxing has to be cheap? No.
They also guarantee that it's going to be really rare that those guys move to Taekwondo.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. Well, and really rare that they stay beyond a month or two, right? I mean, anytime you're doing 10 lesson punch cards, you're just... Would you ever do that for your Taekwondo class? Or your Shotokan class, or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu class, right? So if you're doing a cardio kickboxing program, it should be same price points as everything else. And then if you're going to make it same price points as everything else, you're going to make it a curriculum that's worth that.
That's what Floyd Irwin did, right?
Lloyd?
Not, was it Floyd or who's the one?
Lloyd, Lloyd was Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu and MMA school. Okay. The best version of that we developed internally was with Sean Harvey.
Sean Harvey, I'm sorry.
That ended up being a $249 with an upgrade to $497 cardio kickboxing.
He's having great
results. Yeah, he was doing like $400,000 a year on the cardio with small numbers, right? I mean, he's in Bermuda. He's never going to have big numbers. The entire country is 80,000 people spread out over three islands, right? So, I mean, but is this all making sense? I mean, I don't want it to beat it to death, but in almost all cases, when you have multiple curriculums, you probably would be better off by killing everything but your main thing. And then the other stuff that you have the resources for, put it in the upgrade with the caveat, if it's something that's going to turn off some portion of them, make it optional. And if it's something that they're all going to enjoy, just put it into your curriculum at the upgrade levels.
I would add a couple other factors there. If, you know, we've seen sometimes where there's four or five programs, like Jan's got the Zumba or yoga or something. If that was really trying to be something I was going to integrate into my adult class, for example, not that you're going to do that, but if you're going to integrate that, I have a problem because there's one person. Unless all my guys are trained to do yoga, unless all my guys are trained to do the product, then I'm at risk because now that guy doesn't show up and now it's not part of my product. So, you know, when I've had that happen, I had a guy that was teaching Shotokan and something, and he was a buddy of one of my instructors. Yeah. And they asked if they could come in on Sunday, and they wanted to pay me. And I'm like, I don't care, just go in on Sunday.
Right.
And he had like three students. And one of my other students is a jiu-jitsu. He likes jiu-jitsu. And I just let him come in on Sunday and train. I could charge him rent. If I was going to do something, I'd just charge him a flat rent. Then I only have one collection to make. And I'd just do it through my own billing company. Mm-hmm. And it'd be like a student. They'd be paying me $500 a month or $1,000 a month for rent. Then I'm done. And it takes less... We've got to be really careful. We said this yesterday about delegating the jobs that are menial. We do stuff like this, and it ends up even a little bit of brain power on something. It's a lot of brain power.
They also don't put in what you put in, what you're putting into the whole program. They're just focusing on that, not then thinking, well, I don't have to do what all you are doing in your program.
Yeah, it makes it harder to get the. It makes it harder to increase the quality. You know, like we talked about curriculum on Friday. The more curriculum you have, the lower in the same set amount of time, the lower the quality of the production is. And I think we're that way too. You know, the more stuff we've got to deal with, the lower quality we're going to be in dealing with, because we only have so much brain space to go around. And remember, you know, 186,000, what did I say yesterday? 186,000 classes got taught in South America last year, and they missed three. But how much of their marketing time did they miss? 90% or 80%, you know, so... So we already gravitate towards the stuff that we need to do to make these things successful is part of the challenge.
Well, most people have great difficulty doing one thing at a high level of excellence, much less doing six things that are sort of related at a high level of excellence, right? And, you know, there's examples abound. I mean, if you want to take it out of martial arts, you know, my example that I always like is the Apple turnaround, right? I mean, we may forget now, but when Steve Jobs came to Apple,
they were selling laser printers, they were selling cameras, they were selling Newtons, they were selling a whole bunch of different forms of Mac. They had a huge product line, and they were about 6 weeks from being bankrupt. And the first thing he did is he went in, and after looking at all of it, he said, look, we're going to do personal, professional, portable desktop. That's it. Everything else goes away. And internal to the organization, I mean, and this is a billion-dollar company at the time. I mean, it was already a big company. Internal to the operation, there was great consternation and great fear about how can we possibly do that, because we're doing $150 million on cameras, and we're doing $300 million on laser printers, and we're doing... That's what everybody thought, right? And he had the advantage and the chutzpah to say, look, I'm in charge now. That's what we're doing. Period, end of sentence. If you like it, you know, stay on the bus. If you don't like it, you know, there's the door, right? And in your case, as a pure business decision, the biggest problem we were talking about yesterday, and again, it's the gap in what Commissioner Carrick's situation was versus our situation, is bench strength, right? Who in here thinks that that's a problem for your organization, is having bench strength of instructors? Does it help it or hurt it if you have six different things going on? Oh, it's a massive mess. But if you have one thing going on and everybody else is being developed in that one thing, even if it's an eclectic curriculum, but if you have basically one thing going on, then it's much easier to have a bench of people, right? But if you have a bunch of stuff going on, oh my God, how do you have bench strength on the sword thing, and bench strength on the Taekwondo, and bench strength on the Aikido, and bench strength on the Judo, and bench strength on Zumba, and bench strength, you know, it's a nightmare, right? It's an absolute nightmare. And again, generally, I think most everybody would be better to have one curriculum. And occasionally, you're better off to have two.
I think Apple's a good example there. They made it four computers, and that's all they did. And they did that for quite a long time. Yeah. And they made them really good, and they started making them better. And then they consciously changed their name from Apple Computer to Apple Inc.
Right.
And they came out with the iPhone.
Well, iPod was next.
Yeah. Oh, iPod. You guys are right. iPod. Yeah. iPod came next. But then they didn't come out with the iPhone. They had iPhones and iPads and all that stuff in their drawings somewhere. Yeah. You know, they are constantly trying to come up with some crazy stuff. They've got a million things right now. But you only hear, how often do they release it? Like, you know, every 2 or 3 years there's like a new big changing thing.
Well, and even within that, right, you have the most valuable company in the world and the most profitable company in the world. I believe those are both true statements right now. And their product line really isn't very broad. If you think about it, they have Mac Pro, Mac Air, iMac, Mac Pro, right? That's that original four. And they're phasing out iPod, iPhone, what, three models, and then they have the watch coming, and Apple TV. But if you compare that to, say, a company like Samsung, or you compare it to GE, or you compare it to a bunch of these companies, I mean, it's 1/10 or 1/20 or 1/100 of the number of different things.
Well, in those companies, they have a lot of divisions that are not profitable.
Yeah.
You know, and so they're constantly struggling. Not to say that GE is a good company. It's a good company. Oh, yeah. But we get...
Well, that was Jack Welch's turnaround at GE. His first dictate was, if we're not number one or number two in market share on any division, we're killing it. And he started killing off or selling a whole bunch of different divisions. And again, that was very controversial, because they had a lot of things that were, in that case, $100 million, billion-dollar businesses, but that were not dominant in their industry, and he got rid of them. But again, if you're looking at your operation, and Jan, let's take yours. Clearly, there's no excuse in the world to separately enroll people in an MMA program.
Right.
And it's okay to have a grappling class for the upgrade. Just don't make it mandatory. Mm-hmm. Right?
That's what we do.
Yeah. And then there's no reason in the world for Zumba to exist. There's no reason for yoga to exist. And then the question is it worth your while to be doing transport after school care and things to do, right?
And it is.
And, well, maybe. How much revenue are you doing for tanks a day?
Okay, this month we did 51,000.
Okay. And how much of it was tanks a day?
The majority. Let's see. I could pull it up because I don't know exactly.
Yeah.
But I'd say 30,000 maybe.
Okay, so 30,000 this year. How much of it is transport after school care?
The rest.
So 20,000.
Pretty much, yeah.
Okay.
I'm pulling it up.
Okay. Now, again, let's. Who else in here is doing transport after school care? Why, you're the only one. Okay.
What was your question, sir?
Who else is doing transport after school care in here? Okay, so it's you and Paul, right? Now, is transport after school care as a freestanding business a profitable business? Yeah, okay. It certainly can be, right? I mean, Paul's numbers were main location, and at least a couple of them are at the same level. Main location, $138,000 a month, right? Of that $138,000 a month, $28,000 was the martial arts school, and $110,000 was transport after school care. And the transport after school care, what did he say, was $220 active?
$220
Yeah. Essentially, $220 active at about $500 a month average revenue per per student, right? Now, I mean, that's a real business. And, but the and again, that we don't want to spend a lot of time on this. The question a lot of times is, if you make it a real business like that, then that's great. On the other hand, what do most of the Taekwondo schools do when they do after school care? Well, I've got a $20,000 a month Taekwondo school, and I'm doing $7,000 a month from after school care. And I feel like I can't live without the after-school care because it's paying the rent, right? I mean, is that a fairly accurate description? And so I guess the principle there is, if you're going to do something, do it big, because you've got to make it worth your while. And number two, you've got to make it where you can afford full-time staff to do it. And with this, and Paul is very clearly, and really his operation is three of these, which means six businesses, right? So he's got six locations in essence. He's got three martial arts locations. He's got three transport after school locations. The three transport after, and actually now I think four, but the three after school locations all look very close to this number, right? Two of them are this number, one's a little lower. And then the martial arts locations are this number a little higher, and then one's a lot lower. But he's running really six locations. But the principle here is, this business has a full staff. This business has a full staff. They're not cross-purposing staff, and they're operated as separate freestanding profit centers. And in his case, he has six different businesses that happen to be located in three separate facilities, right? But you've got to think about it that way. But the mistake is to have the same instructors teaching both, have your program director for the martial arts school driving a bus, picking the kids up, that type of thing. Are you?
I do that.
Yeah, don't do that. Yeah, don't do that. You've got to build the transport after school care where it has a separate staff that doesn't have to cross purpose, right? And it's okay to have. My martial arts instructor's afternoon schedule is they have a class at 3, a class at 3:30, a class at 4 that happens to be the transport after school kids, right? But then when you have the instructor driving the bus, or you have the program director having to market for both of them, what they're doing is they're doing both jobs inefficiently, right? And so if you take your number, if all of the, well, okay, so let's take this. You've got a $51,000 a month school, right? And $30,000 of it is tanks to do, $20,000 is transport after school care. The question is if that $51,000 was all tanks to do and this didn't exist,
would you be more or less profitable?
More profitable.
Okay. Would it be harder or easier to do 51,000 with just one thing or two things? My argument is always that it's easier. Okay.
See, I'm not convinced of that at this point.
Well, I know you're not convinced, but you know, I believe now that there's two sides of it. Is it easier to do 51,000 on transport after school care or tanks to go? I would say this is easier. You can get more money. You can get a lot more money. The retention is easier. It's easier to get them, right? So, but 51,000 from transport after school care isn't as profitable as 51,000 from tanks to go.
Right.
Because your overhead is higher here than the number of hours, the number of people you have, right? Mm-hmm. If you want to move 51,000 to 100, which I think is what we're trying to do, right? So if you want to move 51,000 to 100, the question is it better to do it 50,000 here, 50,000 here, or is it better to do it 75,000 here, 25 there, or would it be better to do 100,000 with this or 100,000 with this, right? My argument is always pick the thing that you're passionate. Don't make it as a pure business decision, right? Unless your passion is Aikido. But, if, you know, if it's Tang Sudo or transport after school care. See, have you guys seen ever, like, highly profitable big Aikido schools?
No, they're not.
I always have to check my assumption.
Yeah.
I haven't seen much. It seems to me that that's a more difficult thing to accomplish. But in my mind, you could have 50,000 a month just to Tang Sudo easier than you're doing 50,000 a month right now. Or you could do 50,000 a month transport after school care easier than you're doing 50,000 right now. And you could also move this to 100,000 with a lot less headaches. Now, if you want to move this to 50 and this to 50, it has to be a freestanding staff for this and a freestanding staff for this and very little overlay. Right? It really has to become this is a separate business, this is a separate business. Anytime I have one of my instructors driving a bus, right?
Instructors don't drive buses, well, but my program director, she's the only one, does.
Well, but do you have the same person doing sales for this and sales for this?
Program director and
right.
myself.
And is the program director is also doing marketing for this and marketing for this?
Yes, sir.
There, everybody see what happens, right? So if they're almost by definition. Now, this example is different than you're doing Zumba and karate, right? Because there is synergy between these two businesses. Everybody understand what I mean? So you'll get kids who, these kids come in for a summer camp and then end up being these kids. These kids don't need after-school care anymore, but they love the martial arts, and that you'll get synergy back and forth. And a lot of the marketing activities you can do for this is also marketing activities you can do for this. So there are synergies that wouldn't exist if it was a kids' taekwondo program and cardio kickboxing, right? That don't exist if it's, pick one of those other things. You're doing a judo, track and you're doing a taekwondo track. However, the staffing thing is you've got the people over here doing half as much effort on this thing because they're also having to focus on this. And anytime you split their focus, it's to me, it's very similar. Have you guys looked at the studies recently on multitasking and interruptions, right? Mm-hmm. If you're working on something and you get interrupted, the studies are showing it takes an average of 9 to 10 minutes to get back to the same level of focus, right? So if you're sitting down, you're trying to write a book, you're trying to write a sales letter, and the phone rings and you answer it, and your email blips, every time your interruption gets shifted, it takes quite a bit of time to get back. The principle is the same. If they're off working on this deal, and now you want them to work on this deal, and they shift back and forth, they only have a certain amount of brain power, plus they're in essence splitting focus and never being very efficient on either one. Does that make sense? So, and you guys have some of that where you've had several different things going on and several different curriculum. Questions or thoughts on that? I mean, does somebody have... Hi, Eric, you guys have three things going on, right? Essentially, you have cardio, kickboxing, Muay Thai, and
and the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. And are you still bringing people in for MMA separate and apart from that? Or did you kill that?
They're still there.
They're still there. Okay. So really you have four. Is that right? So I can enroll into MMA. I can enroll into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I can enroll into Muay Thai. Or I can enroll into cardio kickboxing.
They have certain levels in which they can go about that. So you have a cardio, then you have the next level of kickboxing, and then Muay Thai.
Okay.
MMA is not separate. It's mixed martial arts. It's not its thing. It was never, now it's its own title, but when we started, it was mixed martial arts together. So it's not its own program. Because you could train, if you wanted to train different ranges, you could mix them together.
Okay, okay. So basically you enroll me into Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and if I want to, I can also cross-train in Muay Thai. Or you enroll me in Muay Thai, and if I want to, I can cross-train in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. But there's not a third track that's a different animal. Okay, okay. Well, that's fine. I mean, so you're not out. You're really marketing mostly MMA, and then do you want to do grappling, stand-up, or both? Okay, so you really only have one marketing funnel. Okay, so that's not a complication. Does it enhance or detract from your business to also have the cardio piece of it?
No, the attributes that go into MMA is not shape. It's not going to do well. Even for self-defense, not in shape. It's had aggression, spasm down the man who has trained it for years and was so out of shape, couldn't do anything. So it is a component for, it's again part of the program to defend yourself if you want to be in shape. So.
Okay, so now that's a different point. Are you actively marketing for adult women who want fitness as a separate component? Or do you have a kickboxing class that has more of a high-intensity cardio component as cross-training for people? Mm-hmm. Is it both, or
yeah.
It's the second one? Okay, so that changes the dynamic as well. Anybody else have different iterations on that merits addressing? You understand why this is an important point. I mean, it's, you know, Master Moody and Master Smith and I end up talking to all kinds of people who, and many of you, who their biggest problem is they could be very successful doing this, and instead they got this thing going on, they got this thing going on, they got this thing going on, and usually it's, I was enthusiastic about doing yoga, or I was enthusiastic about sword, or I'm a Hapkido guy, but I was enthusiastic about doing grappling, and all of a sudden their school ends up with all these different curriculums. One of the gentlemen I was working with for a while, he had a kung fu program, a taekwondo program, and a Hapkido program. And I was like, well, okay, aren't those really like the same damn thing? Why are you running them separately, right? And his new thing was Hapkido, so he'd bring them in to like a hard style kung fu program, and then their upgrade was put them in Hapkido. But it wasn't like integrating pieces of it. It was a complete separate ranking, and now he's getting ranked in this and ranked in this and ranked in this, and it just made no sense. Does everybody know what I'm saying? Is in almost all cases, I rarely see highly profitable, doesn't mean not big, but I rarely see highly profitable school with low brain damage, with easy operations, that are doing a bunch of different things. Usually it's one curriculum and they do it well. And I rarely see a school that has solved the bench strength problem of staff that has multiple things. Because it just becomes double as hard, triple as hard, quadruple as hard, when you have multiple things going on, because having staff coming up from within on all those different things is just that much more difficult, right? And it's again where I don't get the, I'm a Taekwondo guy and now I want to teach Krav Maga and now I want to teach cardio kickboxing and Apollo Londra, I love kickboxing. Love the guy. He's fantastic. We've had him out. He's doing a bunch of stuff. But it's an integrated part of the upgrade process and something they all love. But I would never have it be where I'm just going out and advertising and trying to bring people in specifically to learn Krav Maga, or specifically trying to learn sticks, or specifically trying to learn XMA. I'd only be using that as then integrated into the upgrade. Does that make sense? Yes, sir.
Maybe related, or at least it reminds me of the feeling of getting scattered.
Right.
Is having different entities, having one business that does this and one business that owns property, and all. Mm-hmm. Now maybe I need a not-for-profit. And
right.
That also gives me that same sort of,
right,
I'm in too many places feeling.
Yeah, that's the conversation we had on the phone. Is you've got to make sure they all serve a purpose. And just as this stuff, there's a lot of things that we end up doing in our business, and it seemed like a good idea at the time. And you always want to make sure that it's going to be simple, clear, and easy. Now, in the things that you talked about, you know, we set up a 501c3 as a nonprofit. In practical terms, it's rare that any money flows through that. And on a purely legal basis, all that matters that you're a legitimate 501c3 is money flows, right? I mean, that's what it's about. But having the 501c3 lets us legitimately go to a public elementary school or to a different charity, one thing or another, and say, we're doing this purely as a nonprofit, as a 501c3, and this is the company. It lets us say that without lying to them. In practical terms, we've always done an awful lot of fundraising, but it's usually a very credible external charity that we're just directing the money to them directly and never touching it. And for any fundraising, any charitable activities you're doing, anytime you can avoid touching the money, you're better off. You know what I mean? Because if the money has to come to you and it goes into your account and then you're going to give them a percentage or keep a percentage, a fair number of people, and the ones that you want the most and want their trust the most, are going to question it, right? Because it's endemic in fundraising and in charities that people are raking off a disproportionate, right? Even the big, you know, I'll use the word Farm Aid, but I haven't looked at that one particularly, but the big things like that where it's a big, like, concerts, you know, so many times it's, they paid for Beyonce's Gulfstream 5 and put her in the suite at the Plaza, and then, you know, paid her $3 million, and the thing grossed $5 million, and everybody else got paid, and the charity got $50,000, right? I mean, that's a lot of what happens. So if you can do something where it's 100% goes to the charity and you don't touch the money, I always prefer they write a check to the charity and we just hand the check to the charity, or we have a link on their website and they just pay and it's automatically going there. But then some of that stuff, it kind of simplifies it again, right? Because you're not, like, accounting for the money. You're not dealing with it. On the other elements, see, I think the best example is this. Tim Kovar and I, back when he and Dave were partners, spent a lot of time back and forth working on their operation and mine and so forth. And what Tim always was predetermined to do, which I almost always successfully talked him out of, was he would do, we're doing a lot of printing, so we're going to buy that print shop. We're doing now transported after school care, so we're going to buy a limo company. And I'm at the opposite end of the spectrum. I want everything outsourced. If I need transportation and there's a transportation company to do it, let them make their 3% profit. I don't want to touch it. And if I need printing, I'll email it over to, you know, to a FedEx office and let them do it. I don't want, you know, last thing I want to do is own a print shop, right? But he was always in that mode of, we're doing so much of it, we might as well just buy the printing company, we might as well just buy the limo company. But then what happens is you're now in a completely separate business, and in most cases you can find somebody who's really good at what they do. I don't care whether it's accounting or student billing or printing or real estate management, whatever it is. You can almost find somebody who's really good at what they do, and as long as they're in a competitive environment, they're making a profit that's not raping you, right? And you know what I mean by that. If they're in a monopoly situation, you might consider not wanting them. But, you know, like the billing companies, none of them are making an outrageous amount of money because they're having to compete with each other, right? So ASF and Member Solutions and EFC and all those guys are competing. So it's not like I'm stuck with paying an outrageous amount. Accountants are the same thing. They're in a very competitive arena at this point, and they've been much have been replaced by QuickBooks Online and stuff like that. So any of that stuff that you can outsource and not touch, you're better off, right? What are some other things that you've gotten bogged down in with that?
It's I guess a little like Kovar trying to be Superman and everything.
Right, right, yeah. Well, and sometimes, again, it makes logical sense on the face of it. You know, you look at it and you say, oh my God, I'm spending $300,000 a year with Century. I'll just import them directly from Pakistan, right? And cut them out. Well, I got to tell you, they're a big ass company, but their margins aren't big, right? I mean, they got a lot of you know, if you've ever been to their office, they've got like three football fields under one roof, and they got a lot of damn people there. And Lloyd Irving was doing that for a while. He had like 3,000 square feet of space in a retail center that was stocking up with all the stuff because he was bringing Sambo or Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu uniforms or whatever from Pakistan so that he wouldn't have to go through a middleman. It's like, you know, we've got schools in New Zealand. They have to. There's no good supplier there, but it's a nightmare. So, you know, any time you have that inclination, you know, like that, I'm just going to order directly from Pakistan and cut out Century or Asian World or whatever. Let them have their profit. You know, don't get into their business.
I just had an example of something that will kind of confirm what you're saying. And this is from advice you gave me years ago. I had a program, it was like a Curves, where I had a whole separate room, and the moms, the idea was that the moms could come in and work out in the Curves and use stations while the kids were training. And it was never successful.
Right.
And we marketed it, and we did all this work and put all this energy into it. We never made any money. Yeah. So finally, reluctantly, I cut it out after saying, you know, you said don't spread yourself so thin. And now I have tons of tiny tigers on that mat. I've turned it into a mat area, and that's thousands of dollars of difference. So that's a perfect example of something that I didn't want to give up because I liked it. I thought it was such a perfect idea.
Yeah. Well, sometimes we're just so invested in our idea, we're desperate to make it work. Mm-hmm. The concept that you mentioned there, though, also applies to all these different people who are trying to create a program for the parents to do, since I already have a captive audience and I have their kids. But guess what? The parents will do the same thing the kids are doing, right? So it's what I hate about, like, the cage fit deal. Well, the reason we're doing the cage fit is we want to have something for all the moms to do, and we're going to do a $10 punch card. The guy I went to Sturgis with, Rob Wetmore, he's like the number one cage fit location in the that they have. And I keep telling him, kill the damn thing. And he goes, oh, no, we're their number one location. I said, if you're the number one location, I hate to see number five, right? But his numbers, last I walked him through the numbers, he has something like 200 cage fit students, but he's making 4,000 gross a month. And this is on a school that's in the mid-40s, right? So, and he's in Allentown. He's a friend of Paul's. He's down the street from Paul. But he's doing mid-40s. 4,000 from cage fit, but he's all excited about it. And I mean, to the point, they have him speaking about how good it is and doing all this stuff. But you don't need a different program for the parents to do, because the parents will do the same thing. And again, it's like your kids' program. You don't need a different program for the kids to do. You just have the same Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu program that the kids can do. Now, you can't mainstream the kids with the adults. You've got to have the kids in a separate class, but you can let the parents train with the kids, right? So, see, and again, it's where Eric and Hi and Travis, you guys end up with the catch-22 backwards. The guys who are predominantly kids, they can expand their adult clientele by just adding the parents in. The guys who have been bringing in mostly adults can't do the reverse, right? So what you've got to do is you've got to add family classes and have adult classes where they can just change all the kids' classes to family classes and then build their adult enrollment, right? How much weight did you lose at the SEAL team thing?
Not a lot.
You've leaned down a lot.
Yeah. It was pretty rough.
Yeah.
Yes, those multi-curriculum. So that one, to maximize those multi-curriculum to not for the regular class.
Yep.
So that one put into the private lesson. So to maximize the benefits of those multi-curriculum, some people. So for my case, those multi-curriculum, I can lead a long time ago.
Right.
And I put into the one dynamic curriculum.
Yep.
Put into the grade. And then at the same time, I'm still working on it to develop the private lesson. So, I have right now six adult who is doing the private. So basically, I evaluate them and customize the training for their need.
Right.
So, able to put into the different curriculum separate for that purpose to maximize the time of my time to put it in to instead of put into the regular program.
Right.
Separate program. So. The one private is like about a year.
Uh-huh.
1 year. About I charge is 16,000.
Okay.
So that's the another way to market that separate target group to able to do those high level.
How many lessons per month are they getting for 16,000 a year?
Usually 2 times a week.
2 times a week.
Yeah.
And so approximately 100 lessons a year, so about $160. Mm-hmm. Are they hour lessons or 30-minute lessons?
Yes,
hour. Okay. So when you break it out, it's about $160 an hour.
Yes.
Right? Are you doing them yourself?
That's the one I do, yes.
You're doing them. Okay.
I do.
Okay.
I don't claim that they would do it yet. So okay. I have the limit
they would
do it.
Eric, what would you say about that? I saw you smirking because I beat you up about it before. Go ahead. I love that story.
You tell it better.
I tell your story better than you do. I think it's better coming from the horse's mouth.
Yeah, it's a business, right? But you're going to get to look at the opportunity cost. So I had a private lesson.
Aaron, could you talk louder, please?
Yeah, so it is a business, but you have to look at the opportunity cost for you. Because I had a client that was flew in and did a private lesson with me for $100. And he said he needed to get back to the airport because his jet cost him $2,000 an hour to leave his jet sitting on the tarmac.
I think you're right. I do tell the story better. He's in Houston, and it was a referral of a friend of Chuck Norris's, right? Chuck's attorney had referred him. Is that right? Who's a real nice guy. I know him pretty well. He was also always essentially his manager. He never actually had a manager. The attorney managed most of his stuff. So the guy is flying from Dallas to Houston to train with Eric. And I had been beating him to death about why he would ever do personal private lessons for $100 an hour. And he said that at first, the first time it really sunk in, is when this guy said, "Well, yeah, I've got to run. I've got the jet on the tarmac, and what do you mean? Well, they're charging me $2,000 an hour to leave it there." And so the guy was taking the Lear or the Gulfstream or whatever it was. Do you know what kind of plane it was?
Yeah,
No? Okay. That'd be interesting to know, because then we could compute the hourly rate of flying the thing. But let's say it's a Lear, because there, you know, let's say it was a cheap one. So, you know, $2,000 an hour per air, you know, air hour or something like that. So the guy's paying $2,000 or $3,000 every time he comes from Dallas to Houston to train with Eric. And Eric was only asking him, and he was paying whatever he asked him was, they charge him $100 an hour. How many here are teaching private lessons in some fashion?
We offer, but most instructors teach.
It's part of the program, right?
Well, I don't mean like that.
Right.
I don't mean Joey's going to come in and we're doing a little private evaluation. I mean, you're setting up a package where they're paying for private lessons. So, you are, right? Who else? Okay. The way to think about it is this. And you know, the number that you said, Jay, sounds good on the surface, because you go, wow, you're making, you know, $1,500 a month or something like that for the student. But where it falls apart is when it's your personal time for $160 an hour. And the way I always like to think about it, and you could argue my calculation, but if I want to do a $100,000 a month school, that means I need a $25,000 a week school. So a $25,000 a week school divided by 40 hours a week is how much? I used to be good at math. So that's $2,500. It'd be
600
something. So your time has to create $600 for every hour you spend, if that's your goal, right? So now that's your threshold. So if somebody wanted to pay you $600 an hour for you to teach them privately, if that's your goal, $100,000 a month, then that'd be worth trading an hour of your time for $600, right? But at $160, $160 times 40 is what? That's 4,000 plus 6,400. So that puts you on track to gross $30,000 a month. Well, see, so you're already grossing more than that, right? So your overall gross is more than that. So every hour that you put doing a private lesson, you're actually earning less than you're earning the rest of the time, right? So what you just got to think about that way. Now, if the dynamic was, and I forget his name, the guy from Florida, I believe, who was trying to package private lessons. We were trying to help him joint venture with it for a while, but he just never quite knew how to present it. But he was packaging private lessons, but he had this whole system in place. And, I mean, he was having, people pay him $100,000 for a four-year package and things like that. I mean, seriously, I mean, at least asking for it. But he also had a system in place where he had the staff development in place where he wasn't teaching them, where it was staff teaching them. And a fair number of schools, I think it tends towards the MMA guys, but have a place where they think of private lessons just like personal training. And then I've seen where you can get in big trouble is you're paying the staff guy half of the private lesson fee, and then you're paying him $2,000 a month or whatever to teach group classes, and the imbalance in their income is so great that they're just focusing on the privates. That's a big mistake, right? Then the second thing that happens is you set it up in such a way that the student isn't looking at, I have a private with the instructor. They look at it in such a way that this guy is the expert and I want to go with this guy. And then all of a sudden, as you set up even a higher incentive for him to go across the street or keep teaching group classes and teach everybody on Sunday in his garage. And it's really easy for that to spiral out of control. You've got to be real careful about that. Does that make sense? But, you know, on the surface, there's nothing at all wrong with that number except that it shouldn't be you teaching it. Right? So if you're getting people who are doing that kind of private lesson package, now I would be very careful about having it be predicated on learning a curriculum or something different than you're doing in normal classes that only you know, or that is so specialized that only you can teach, right? Yeah. So you've got to solve that piece of it. And, you know, I think in all of our schools, you probably have quite a few people who would pay that for private lessons. Or they would pay that to get an additional private lesson periodically or something. But you've got to be very careful how you structure it. One, so you don't funnel them to somebody who becomes the expert outside of yourself and builds a bond with somebody that shouldn't be there. And number two, that you're not investing your own time inappropriately. Does that make sense? Anybody have anything to add to that? And Greg, that's completely different than I'm going to schedule Joey for a series of little privates to get him integrated, or I'm going to do a little private progress update. All of those things are all useful. But as long as you don't set it up where they expect that, as opposed to it's a pleasant surprise and it's a good opportunity.
On the flip side, I kind of used that and shot myself in the foot for a while when we were trying to close some of the upgrades. We used that as kind of a perk, and I quickly learned my lesson on that one because then
that's going to kill you.
Like that's I better take advantage of that because I'm paying it for that upgrade, and then they're trying to schedule private lessons left and right.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, that's going to get you in big trouble. That's going to get you in big trouble, which you already learned. Well, good. Anything else on those topics before we spend 3.5 or 4 solid hours on Renewal Blitz? No? Everybody good?
Yes.
Okay. Anything else to wrap up on Commissioner Carrick or anything from yesterday or from a West Point tour? He's very open to doing just about anything. He was wanting to come. Now, of course, he's very busy, but he was wanting to come out to our Black Belt retreat this year, and the timing was bad, so he's already committed to come out next year. In all likelihood, we could work something in somewhere where he's going to be on the book tour. He lives right, in Franklin Lakes, which is about an hour from here. So, he's very open for that, other than I'm certainly hoping that his schedule is going to be so busy that it's hard to book him in, right? So I'm certainly hoping that his career re-catches back to where it was before all of the challenges.
How can we find out his book tour?
I'll let you know. Not a self-interested way. I was getting ready to say the opposite, but none of us have any vested interest other than it'd be nice to see it be successful. Is I'll be letting you know because on a big publisher book like this, they're very focused on getting on the New York Times bestseller list, right? Because that becomes a self-perpetuating thing. And so, what I'll be letting everybody know is the target bookstores and the release date and the target week so that we can encourage everybody to go get it at that point and help push it up the list, right? I mean, there's some of the books are focused on the niche and Amazon or something, but this is a big publisher thing. There's going to be a documentary about the same time on all the judicial side of what happened to him. There's in negotiation for there to be a miniseries on the table, and there's been talk of I think the rights to both books have already been purchased, but I don't hold me to that to do a movie. And movie industry is very fickle. There's an awful lot of stories that the rights get published and never sees the light of day, but there may well be a major or a minor movie based on the two biographies. And if you haven't read the first biography, it's really good. I'm not sure it's still available, but it was called Lost Son, and it was had all been written just prior to 9/11. So I mean, it prior to 9/11, and it was released right after 9/11. In fact, there was some criticism of the fact that it came so closely after release of 9/11. But the reality was, it was already scheduled for release. And actually what they did is they pulled it and they put a little bit of discussion about 9/11 in it before it went out. But it came out right after 9/11. It had been in the can for about a year before 9/11. So, but it's a very interesting story of, you know, very, very much rags to riches, right? But anyway, okay. So let's do this. Let's take a 7-minute restroom break. So let's take 6 minutes and we'll focus on renewals and upgrades intently. Master Moody. Are we good on the video and audio?
Right now, unless we can change out.
Here's the memory cards. I am. Go ahead and stay.
Yeah, so I was talking to Greg, and he was mentioning that with his new enrollments, he never sees dropouts, or next to never sees dropouts within the first 2-3 months, and with myself and a few other people that I've talked to, that's the biggest point that we have dropouts is in the first couple months. If we can get them past that point, they're usually stick around for a while. And I was trying to just figure out what some of the differences were as to why
right.
we're seeing such differences.
Yeah, Greg, what's your initial observation? I mean, you guys were just talking about that.
I mean, we went through both sides of things as far as his initial down payment, is that initial down payment being high will, again, kind of add that
will help.
Value and help them, you know, be tied in from the parents' perspective anyway. Mm-hmm. Now, if Johnny's just not wanting to come back to class because he's intimidated and stuff like that, I looked at it from the perspective of, well, one is the classroom environment, either one is not exciting enough for the kids to really be motivated and it's a good class, or it could be just the thing we talked about on Friday where the curriculum or something might be just too overwhelming, it's too challenging, it's too, they're intimidated, they might be a little bit scared or something like that, and that's kind of where we started trying to approach that anyway.
Yeah, and see, I think this is a really good start anyway to talking about upgrades regardless. And Jeff, in your case specific, your attrition problem is more with the adults than with the kids, right?
Right.
But see, the thing that I had been telling people for years to do and trying to get done, frankly, in my own schools, is treat the new student process not like it's an intro, and I enroll here, and I enroll here, and then I give you an ID card, and I throw you into class. But treat it more like it's an introductory period for a couple of months, certainly for the first month, and hold them by the hand throughout that process. And that's, there's multiple reasons for that. One of them is to ensure good retention at early on, and the other is to ensure that you get them upgraded early on, right? And you can look at it either way. And the first time I saw anybody doing exactly what I'm talking about was almost 25 years ago when Jay Kim was courting me to, he won Ernie Reyes and myself and perhaps some others that I don't know about, but he was trying to court us to be part of his organization. And but that was something that Jay Kim did, and I was very unimpressed with 99% of their curriculum student service retention. But what I was impressed with is the way they did it was financially motivated, is basically they were presenting initially an 18-month enrollment or a Black Belt Club enrollment. If you didn't enroll the Black Belt Club, they put you on essentially privates or semi-privates with the instructor for the first month to upgrade you into Black Belt Club. And where it was almost purely, in their case, a sales gimmick, is Keith Hafner and I talked about this and several others, and he called it a quick start process, where for the first 8 lessons or so, they would schedule an appointment, they'd have an instructor who was assigned, And it wasn't separate from the beginner class, but it was before or after the beginner class, where an instructor is assigned to work with them individually to make sure that they knew the various pieces of what they were supposed to be doing, to get them fully acquainted to the school and clear on what's going on. And, you know, the story I've told many times is it really came back to be aware of with me when I went and took flying lessons. And here I am in essentially the same kind of school environment that we run, taking lessons for which I had no clue how it worked. And I went to this school for 2 or 3 months and was very conscious of the process pretty quickly, because it dawned on me that 2.5 months later I was still completely confused on how everything worked. I had no idea how their website worked. I had no idea how you scheduled times. I couldn't remember the name of the instructor, and I'm not sure he ever told me what his name was. I could go on and on, but never quite knew what the test process was. What I knew is I had this big bag of books, and I had like a flight log, and I had a couple of textbooks, and you know, I'm enough of an academic nerd, you know, I can memorize the textbooks, no problem. But it was like, how does all this work? And they had a website where you're supposed to schedule things and so forth. But I went through 2.5 months at this school, and I did drop out. They went out of business, which is indicative, right? But I went through 2.5 months of this school, never really quite understanding how it all worked, right? And it wasn't like I was afraid to ask. I mean, I imagine somebody more timid or less educated. It wasn't like I was afraid to ask. It was just I was kind of busy, and they'd kind of tell me, and I kind of thought I understood, and then I'd get home and realize that I didn't know how it worked and didn't know who to ask. And I think our students it's a combination of both those factors. The martial arts thing, and perhaps the flying thing is the same thing, but it's kind of intimidating. I was never intimidated by the process. I was just, I knew I didn't know how it all worked and was kind of confused. And frankly, might have been more prone to just like stop going and find somebody else than to go figure it out, as sloppy as they were about the process. Does that make sense? And so when it comes to getting the kind of upgrade numbers that we've talked about, you know, those outlier numbers of 87% or 90% of everybody who enrolls ends up upgraded, the only way you ever get that is you never get a year enrollment, throw them over the wall to the instructor, let them take class, and then go try to pull them out. See, that doesn't work. You set them up right at the beginning to understand that, you know, it's a process to get to black belt and beyond, however you want to use that terminology appropriately for Krav or whatever it might be. And this initial enrollment is just a trial enrollment. But then what you want is that, and I like Keith's terminology, have that quick start process where you're making appointments. And again, I'd rather see that I have like 15 minutes slotted before or after the beginner class. And I'm making an appointment, and now it's maybe an instructor with 2 or 3 people who are on the 3rd or 4th lesson. And I'm walking them through. Here's how the ID card works. Here's what you need to do. The reason there's these slots is every 2 months you need 16 classes and 2 slots per week. And we're good, right? I mean, explaining to them in very specific detail. One of the things that, you know, we always did, but Jeff Smith took it to a much higher level and we've integrated, is we'll schedule them on the 3rd class for... he's come to call it the notebook conference or something. But basically we have the little student manual. And we won't give it to them when they enroll. It'll be an appointment next for them. And at that next appointment, they're walked through the ID card, but they're also walked through the little student manual. And the student manual is mostly about, this is a self-discipline card, and if you fill this out and turn it in, Joey's going to get rewarded at the test, and this is a homework card, and this is how this works. And so it's just kind of item by item walking them through that material. including he's going to be scheduled to test for his gold belt on this date. Here's how many classes he's going to need. You know, that type of detail. Is that helping a little bit, Jeff?
Yeah.
And so, again, from the standpoint of this as an upgrade tool, if you really are scheduling them by appointment, and you've got one of the instructors, and as an owner-operator, that might be you. I mean, this is a very valuable use of your time. If you have an instructor that knows, okay, on Tuesday for the 6:15 class, we have Eric, and Greg scheduled to come in at 6, and they're all in lesson 3 or 4, so here's what we want to do, and then he, you know, brings the kids and the parents, or he brings the adults together, and you know, walks them through procedures a little bit, and here's where you put your bag, and here's where you change, and here's where you do this, and by the way, when you come into the school, you need, right? I mean, just in detail, ad nauseum, those things. And then, you know, brings them out and says, okay, now in class today, we're going to do this, so, you know, let's get a little bit of a head start, and we're going to work on this a little bit, and then hand them off into the class.
So if you're doing that for the first 8 lessons, though, and you have that 6:15 class and 2 people are on their first or second lesson and 4 or 5 people on their 6th or 7th lesson, they've already heard that, and you have a different step for each stage, how do you make that to where everybody's getting some benefit from that little additional meeting?
Well, presumably, you would... I guess the first specific answer is it's more about personal rapport and about making sure they feel their hands being held through the process than it is the specific information. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So I want to answer it that way to begin with. I think the second piece of it would be is you probably want to differentiate it a little bit, right? You know, if you did have that, if you have 4 people and one of them's been there for 8 lessons, one of them's been there for 6 lessons, and one of them's on the 3rd lesson, you have the person with 8 lessons explain to the person on the 3rd lesson how it all works. You see what I'm saying? So you get that kind of, and now you know that they know what it is, and they feel good because now they're the expert explaining to the other person, then you can help them out. Does that help a little bit?
Yeah.
How long? Are you recommending the hand-holding?
At least for the first month. You know, if it's the first 8 to 10 lessons. So we're always looking at the upgrade period to be within that first 2 months. But I think the first month is crucial because you just, again, if I'm confused, so many times, perhaps I'm even confused and I don't know I'm confused, right? So I don't know that this thing is supposed to go here, or I've never pulled my card. And you know, then there's some things that we do in the school. I would say almost everything that we do in the school is so second nature that we assume with simple explanation they understand. And it's almost never that way. And so we want to make sure. See, the worst thing you can do is now 2.5 months later, and you blame the student for not having enough lessons on their card because they didn't know to pull it. And most instructors will end up in an accusatory tone at some point for something that really wasn't the student's fault. Right? If I, as the instructor, never let a day go by without knowing that you turned it in, got credit, did the thing, then there's never a point for it to be a fracturing of the relationship. On the other hand, if I let it go a little bit, then I'm a little accusatory about, well, you know, it's your responsibility, and, you know, and certainly we're trying to teach leadership for our students. We want there to be a no-excuse environment, but that's brown belts, right? That's not white belts. And so we've got to understand how that thing evolves. And it's, Jeff, as you and I were talking about, I rarely see anybody, I frequently see schools that teach too much stuff in the first year, right? and or teach stuff that's more physically complicated than the instructor thinks it is, right? And if you're looking at, you know, if there is a demographic trend of late, is that kids and adults have spent less time outside doing sports activities and so forth, and more time on their iPhone or their iPad or one thing or another. And I think we've got to assume generally a little bit less level of physical coordination and so forth, right? And there's oftentimes a lot of stuff that we teach that seems really simple to us that, you know, isn't that simple. I mean, hell, I still have that, right? I mean, you know, every now and then I do some of the grappling stuff with the grappling guys, and I suck at it. But it's not so much that I physically suck at it. My mind doesn't work that way. So the explanation takes a while for me to get. Does that make sense? And the opposite is true. You know, I'll find myself with somebody who's great at grappling, and I'm trying to explain how to, you know, how to jab somebody in the chin and knock them out, and they're like, you know, it's just, you know, the, you know, to me it's like, well, you do this, no big deal, and they leave with a hand, and but they don't get it. But it, you know, we underestimate how foreign a lot of this stuff is to our student, and we've got to be real step by step to hold them by the hand, because if they get frustrated or confused, they go away, right?
Do you have an enrollment package?
No.
That was one of the things that I think really helped us, is just getting that enrollment package. I think we got it from the National site. I'm not sure.
Is it on the website?
What's that?
Is it on the website?
I can't remember.
I don't know.
It's a simple document. You can quickly generate something that just says, here's, and make it a checklist, you know, like.
Just like Mass Movie was talking about yesterday.
Yeah, make it a checklist. You know, you have to do that. I know how to do this. I taught you how to tie your belt. You know, here's how you pull your card. You understand our testing cycle, when we're supposed to be testing next. You know when Johnny's testing for his bull belt. And then put the renewal prep in that too, where you're saying, you know, during the next 3 months, we're going to be evaluating, 2 months, we're going to be evaluating Johnny to see if he's ready to set his goal to become a black belt and, you know, go into leadership or whatever.
And all the simple stuff that seems obvious, if you know, like we have gray carpet with red mats and there's no shoes on the red mats, but they don't know that. I have to, like, tell them and remind them and point it out. And by the way, if you're going to take your shoes off, there's some place it has to go. Well, your shoes go over here. And, yeah, I mean, so there's all those little things. If you want them to bow on and off the floor when it's there, they need to be taught 3 or 4 times, and it needs to be in the checklist, and it needs to be part of the deal. Because, you know, the biggest thing is if I feel like, you know, just... It's the emotional feeling that they get of suddenly they're part of the thing, and suddenly they understand it, and they're behaving like everybody else, and they understand how class. That's a very powerful emotion that we underestimate. And in contrast, that confusion of they gave me this weird uniform kimono thing, and how does this work, and they've got it, you know, crossed backwards or tied backwards or whatever it might be. Is that confusion that goes with the opposite is very powerful as well. Powerful negative, but it's very powerful. So you've got to be aware of all those little fault points, if that makes
sense.
That's
why I like doing introductory lessons one-on-one, their first class or their second class, because if you throw them in with a group, a lot of people, you know, have a $49 offer, they pay $49 and they throw them in a group, and that's even the worst case of throwing them over the mountain. I mean, they haven't even done anything yet. We throw a uniform on them that we tie, and then they don't know how to put it back on the next day, and then we toss them into the class, and then they're doing class. And part of that intro process, it's to do the sale, but it's also to acclimate them.
Right.
And make that acclimation process last longer. But I was just thinking, we're at West Point, I think they've got kind of a lot of acclimation process, don't they? I mean,
The
boot camp before they even are qualified to be a West Point student, and then they, you know, they go through that process, and so.
Well, and what did she mention the first day? I mean, they took him in, gave him a haircut, and then there was a whole list of, you know, how you tie your thing. When I took Jada to Sophie's, same thing at Air Force Academy. They do boot camp to begin with, and they have a ceremony when you're actually admitted from boot camp. So we went to the ceremony and then went and toured the barracks and so forth. And it was really interesting because, you know, they've got to keep the beds perfect, right? I mean, perfect. And so here we are, you know, with Sophie going through the dorms, and she says, well, a lot of the cadets just sleep on top of the bed. And some of them are even smarter and sleep on the floor because they only give them, like, I don't know, you know, 2 minutes from wake up to line up. And so now, since it all has to be perfect and they're going to get expected, they just don't, like, mess the bed up, so they're not going to have to fix the bed, right? And I said, well, you know, do you sleep okay, you know, like that? She goes, oh, we're so exhausted at the end of the night, we could sleep, you know, we could sleep on the concrete floor out there. Wasn't a problem. But it's, you know, all of those little things to teach them and indoctrinate them on the process, right? And it really is kind of like you're joining the secret club. And until you know what the secret handshake is and what the ring means and what the thing is and, you know, what the special way to open the door is, then you haven't fully indoctrinated them into it.
Well, and two things happen. One is they feel more comfortable.
Yeah.
And they're more, but the other is they feel like they belong.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more of a myth. You miss it if you don't go.
Yeah.
You know, it's there's a connection. You're making a connection. Mm-hmm. It's comfort and connection when they do that.
Yeah. You know, the other thing, one of the things I was impressed when I was down in Jacksonville watching both the staff training and the actual classes was, you know, Master Clark was having all the parents stand and do the creed and all the different stuff. So when the class was happening, this is a few years ago, when the class was happening, it was the parents were really part of the class even though they were in the spectator area. And, see, those types of things are very powerful. I've been to schools where, you know, the junior schools used to be like this. You have like a glass spectator area. Now there's a coffee pot and there's a stack of magazines and there's all this stuff. No. One of the things that I first did when I was in Washington was we pulled all the parent chairs out and put them on the floor and took some duct tape and put a strip, and the parents were right there as part of the floor. But the more you get everybody acting like they're now a martial artist, you're the better off you are. On your various programs, and again, you're running grappling, Muay Thai, Tai Chi, and something else, right?
JKD.
What's that?
JKD is real.
JKD. Do they all have a specific predefined uniform?
Yes.
Okay.
Some of the uniforms are the same, though, like our stand-up and a scream.
No, that's fine. But none of them come in as wet pants. And,
no.
Okay, good. I think it's always, for anybody who does, that's always a mistake. You know, the school uniform is a helpful tie-in. And the other thing that's a mistake is, you know, you let them wear whatever they want as long as it's a, you know, a jiu-jitsu uniform or a karate uniform. You know, I see schools where you can wear black, red, green, blue, whatever, as long as it's, I don't mind having multiple colors, but I want it to mean something, right? You know, like in our case, the blue top means they're in leadership. The all white means that they're a student uniform, and then the black pants means that they're a black belt, and then the all blue uniform means they're a master level black belt. So when you look at them, it means something. And so, you know, regardless of the curriculum, whether it's a Krav or a Muay Thai or whatever, if they're all required to wear a certain thing. And this works fine in cardio kickboxing as well, by the way, as we've seen the same thing where it all means something and there's a rank progress with the shirt or something or other. So it creates that sense of uniformity. Anything you'd add to that, Master Moody?
And the argument, sometimes we hear people say, well, yeah, but if I have different uniforms that they can wear, you know, and they have variety, now I can sell more merchandise. And that's just, any time we do stuff to sell more merchandise, I mean, I can't think of a case that it's really productive. I mean, merchandise should be a complementary thing that does add a little bit of income and add some income, but, you know, you shouldn't structure your programs and give up the possibility of upgrading somebody to a $5,000 or $10,000 program because you're going to sell them some, as opposed to having them on uniform. So it should integrate with the $10,000 program, not be for its own sake.
Right.
Not merchandise for its own sake.
Yeah, that is a little tangent, but let me ask the question. Does anybody still have a pro shop in your school? Why?
Because we've always had it.
Yeah. I'm so jaded that if I never had to handle another piece of retail in my life, I would never touch another piece of retail. And that's what I like about like the Century Direct, and they can drop ship and all that stuff. But having said that, is you can sell way more retail by just have the school logo bag with all the crap in and at the given benchmark, and I like it to be they just upgraded the leadership. At the given benchmark, you either charge them the $500 for the equipment package or whatever the number is. That would be high, but you just charge them the number for the equipment package, or you make them pay a big enough down payment that it's just all included, right? I'd much rather see that. And I've never seen anybody be able to do profitably more retail any other way. And the problem with a pro shop, aside from taking up square footage, is you have to maintain inventory for it. You always have slippage in inventory because your staff is kind of helping themselves to what they want. And the branded stuff like T-shirts and so forth, you know, the only way I've ever made any money on that stuff is event-based. So, you know, like the big open tournament, you can make a ton of money on selling event shirts for that thing on the date. You can do that internally as well. I mean, when we'd have Junry out for a black belt test, I could do things with Junry and me and Jeff Smith and the date and sell a ton of them. But things you just kind of keep in stock normally tend to be collect dust, and by the time you're done with the margin, you know, the best I've ever seen. How much do you do in the pro shop?
Not very much, a couple thousand.
Yeah. Well, you'd be doing more than a couple thousand just in equipment packages.
Well, we do equipment packages, and we consider that just part of their. We charge like $5.97, and they get a package.
Right. Okay. Good. But other than that, it's just almost always a waste of time. I mean, I've looked at the numbers. I've looked at the numbers across my locations. And by the way, Shulman came to the same conclusion. He used to have big pro shops. He got rid of it. Clark came to the same conclusion. Over and over and over, people come to the same conclusion. Shulman.
But the difference is, I think the distraction is like a lot of these other things. Well, the distraction is, and I remember there's a video I saw about martial arts pro shops a long time ago, and they compared it to golf pro shops. You know, if a golf course, they make a ton of money from their pro shop. And if you like golf, then you go, and a lot of times you buy a polo shirt or hat or something. If the pro shop, you always do that.
Well, the pro shops are selling, you know, $300 big whatever it's called, clubs.
Well, that's one thing, but the other thing is they're rotating the people that are there.
Right.
We have the same, if you have 300 students even, you have the same 300 students, you know, for a long time. If you have even a halfway decent, you know, attrition rate, it's the same people, you know, so you don't have, they just don't need that much crap.
Yeah. Well, if anything, they come in as a white belt and they're really enthusiastic and they, you know, would love to have a bunch of different stuff, and then after that, it's, you know, it's sort of same old. But again, that's a tangent. But the main thing is to really get focused on, when you do a new student, to solve your attrition but to improve your upgrade numbers as well, is get in the habit of, and again, Greg was talking about the student manual. And sometimes what I see is a student manual is this big notebook with all the curriculum and pictures and descriptions. I'm not worried about physical curriculum stuff. What I want is behavioral, right? So the student manual could have the physical testing requirements to the next belt, and it's the different types of things that you want them to do as support materials. And a key component... this is not kids program specific, but a key component, like what's hitting Jeff Smith's numbers with this, is like lesson three, I give you the self-discipline card, and now you have an assignment between now and the next lesson to go get started on it, and then bring it back where you've completed that level. And then at the next lesson, I give you, let's say, the reading card. and you have an assignment to complete a little bit more on this, but to start this and bring it back. And so now what's happening is there's behavioral expectations that are reflected by the various homework assignments that are being sent home and checked to see whether they were done when they were brought back. And what it does is it gets them engaged in the process. And the ones that are going to renew anyway are the ones that engage in the process, right? The second thing that happens in the kids is the ones that are going to renew are the ones where the parents have seen positive behavioral changes at home, improvements in discipline, one thing or another, right? That was one of the most powerful things we did with those after-school enrichment programs. You know, say thank you, I love you, go clean your room, respect the teachers, things like that. So now there was not only a behavioral assignment was being done, but there was an expectation of the parents or the teacher signing off that they did it. Does that make sense? So if you give them specific assignments between these that they have to go do and then check up that they did it, now you get engagement in the process. Right? Does that make sense? And so it's a, you know, it's a very, very important part of that solution.
How often do you run them, generally speaking, or isn't there an exact science to it?
What do you mean?
Like you know, your sheets that you all have for these character development skills, I just sign on a weekly basis, a monthly basis, the stripes, that kind of thing, or when they choose.
Most of these, there are some that are like a weekly sheet, but they're really all focused around the testing cycle. So every two months, you know, at a certain level of completion, they're now getting rewarded at the testing cycle. So it goes back to Marty's conversation of, you know, you've completed the self-discipline sheet, you get, you know, recognized in front of everybody.
You must have those completed for the testing cycle to be approved for the testing cycle as well, or no?
A lot of that is optional, not obligatory.
Okay.
But they're getting rewards for it, right? So they're getting medals or trophies or something like that as part of the test for having completed it.
Right.
And the latest iteration, and this is Jeff Smith's iteration, is there's an award for having completed, you know, this one, and this one. So having, you know, not only there's an award for completing the discipline sheet, but there's a discipline, healthy eating, homework assignment. If you did all four, there's a special award for having done all four.
Okay.
Right?
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
But a lot of this is just in the process of getting them to engage in what the system is,
sure,
right?
Because
whether it's kids or adults, a lot of times there's a piece of paper or something that goes home with them, and guess what? It's never looked at again.
Right.
Okay, I can't tell you the number of things that I go do and so forth, and you get the bag, but what happens to the bag? You know, I've done a bunch of big, expensive seminars, and the bag from the seminar is still sitting in the closet. You know, and all the same stuff in the same order that it ever was, and you know,
look at it.
Yeah. You know, after schlepping it home on the plane, I never opened the bag again, right? And at the time, I was very serious about, you know, this is important, and I want to make sure I keep this, and I want to. Yeah, you never.
This is perfect because I'm literally laying this out right now.
Yeah,
right?
So. Yeah. Okay, is this helping?
Yes, sir.
And so, Eric, now you're back. What's your dropout rate like for adults in the first couple of months?
Well, that's what we don't. What we're at right now is we're not able to measure. We haven't been keeping stats on it.
Okay.
And so we don't know.
Well, you know that's a problem.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
That's what the last 2 weeks have been trying to.
Okay. What's your average monthly attrition for the adult program?
It's 4.68 right now.
Okay. Well, that's a lot better than where you're at.
That's great.
Yeah. I wouldn't say it's great, but I mean it's an improvement from where you're at. What's your dropout rate with the kids program?
Well, we'll go like right this month. It's 2%.
Okay.
But
the last
month, or a couple of months ago, we had
6% month. So. Yeah. July probably. Yeah. Yeah. So probably you're in the 4%. So you're a little bit better than the adults, but it's comparable. Is that something right?
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, and truthfully, on a big school, 4% is pretty good. I've seen that get as low as a little under 2% a month. And so if you're going to benchmark, you know, where you want to be, probably 4% is a good starting point, and then get it down under 2%, certainly on a single school owner-operator, is completely doable. Maury, do you know what your monthly draw is?
3%.
3%? So you have some room for improvement, but it's pretty good. Yeah, yeah. There's going to be a percentage that there's just nothing you can do about, right? So there's the percentage of move out of state, one thing or another, you know, lose their job, some kind of permanent injury. But that's usually, and again, different areas are different. Like in the Hudson Valley, there was a time when IBM was shutting down all the stuff. I remember when Don was still up here. There was nothing he could do. You know, IBM moved the plant to India, and you know they're you know moving to the Sun Belt to look for jobs. I mean, you're not going to improve your retention with that. You know, the last big recession, we had one of the schools that was mostly oil and airlines, and when the airlines got hit and all the oil moved from Denver back to either Houston or Bartlesville. There wasn't anything we could do about that, right? So, you know, a bunch of our students were heading back to your territory because, you know, they were, you know, Phillips was based in Bartlesville, and then a bunch of them were in Houston or Texas. So, you know, when they got crunched, they just closed, you know, the secondary office, which was in many cases Denver. But, you know, short of that is, I mean, that's what's doable, right? And, you know, across different curriculums is certainly we see like a traditional-ish Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu program or a well-run traditional-ish Muay Thai program or Tai Chi program. They should be able to have, you know, as good a retention as anything else. Occasionally we've seen like women's cardio fitness programs have good retention, but it seems to be the hardest one of the group. You know, they are preconditioned to be flighty, right? So you've really got to do a lot of work. And so, like, if you take the program that I talked about in Bermuda or similar program, they had really good retention. But it was not just put them into a cardio class. It was monthly progress checks, weigh in, talk to them about their goals and objectives. I mean, it was a real program with progress levels just like any other program. So, any other thoughts for helping him with that initial attrition? I mean, this whole renewal process is going to be the biggest piece of it. But any other quick thoughts on that?
Yeah, my thought process is exactly what you're laying out. Is yeah. The fact that it's monthly, and then every other month they're getting awarded something, mm-hmm. And that's again having them grow up to this point, and then I earn this.
Right.
To this point, and I earn that. I think that's what's so vital.
The only thing I may add is that fundamentally, even more fundamental than all the stuff we're talking about, we're trying to talk about what we can do to enhance things
right.
To make it better. But sometimes you might have that trouble. I'm not saying in this case, but because the classes might just be too hard.
Yes. That was the first thing I said when we were talking
okay.
over there.
Okay.
Is you both need to make sure that you have a slim enough curriculum that there's not too much stuff for them to learn early on. But also to make sure the stuff that they're learning on is relatively easy to master, right? And so, you know, like the Taekwondo version is you know, I don't want to teach them sidekick immediately or teach them reverse sidekick immediately because they're all going to do it wrong. But, you know, they can do a front snap kick. So I'm going to be teaching them something that's easy enough that they can do, not complicated enough that they feel frustrated, right? Eric, what's the jiu-jitsu version of that? What do you want to avoid? What do you want to teach early?
Yeah, I mean, the popular says it's coming through the door, and then it's what you just said. Sometimes it's too complicated.
Yeah.
I feel like crap. It's poor leadership.
Right.
The flip side of that too can be we've got a friend that teaches Gundo Master Monday, does Gundo, and the way that their system is, I mean, they'll send
does what
Gundo, so sword.
Okay,
and it's really great, and he's awesome. It's great taking class from, but
there are certain groups of that where they'll spend 3 months just standing in a stance, taking the sword out of the scabbard, you know? I mean, they'll just do that for months. And, you know, it would bore most normal humans.
Right.
But people in this room probably think that was cool, you know, and they think it was awesome. And so that's part of our perception, is I say this in the last, everybody thinks it's funny when I say it, but we're like a bunch of mutants. You know, we're weird that we, you know, we wouldn't be in this room unless we were kind of unusual people. And we can't expect.
Well, and the longer you've been in martial arts in this room, the more warped and perverted in that sense you were.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, if you started in the 60s, God help us, and that was me too. And if it's the 70s, it was still a weird, bizarre place. So.
Yeah, we got it.
Who goes back to the 70s or the 60s? Do I exaggerate?
No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we've got to make sure our perception is what, like, the civilians are, what the normal people are. And it should be not too hard. The best study on this that I've ever seen done in terms of happiness is people are happiest when they're in flow. The concept of flow, and a guy named Kyle Csikszentmihalyi did this huge study about this.
Yeah.
And they found that people are the happiest when they're doing things that are hard, but not too hard. Not when they're doing easy things, not when they're doing going to Disneyland or riding rides. They're the happiest when they're engaged in something that's hard, but not too hard, that is related to a goal and is measurable. And they see measurable steps along the goal. And that's what we have. The error we make sometimes is we make it too hard or too easy. It should be hard, but not so hard they don't feel that they can do it. And if you can keep on that edge of it's always that way, then people should be very, very engaged. So that kind of encompasses everything we're talking about, that one concept. It should be, you know, those three things.
What was that again? Hard?
Well, it should be hard, but not too hard. It has to be related to a goal. So there should be something like getting your black belt, like something, some goal-related thing, and it should be measurable.
Yeah.
So if the goal is to feel good, that's not really measurable in most ways, you know. So that's not a very good. There's probably a lot of other examples we think of where people want to get in shape. Get in shape is not it's a goal. Get in shape is a goal. You kind of know if you're there, you know, but it's not really measurable. You have to find it. So the goal has to be measurable. But a hard but not too hard is the one that was really a surprise, because they thought when they started the study it was going to be when people were doing certain activities. They thought it was people were, you know, resting, or people watching TV, or it wasn't any of that stuff. It was when they were working, they were doing stuff that was hard, but just not too hard, so they didn't feel like they could do it. So it was goal-oriented and it's measurable.
Yeah, and that's a good book reference.
Mikhail Csikszentmihalyi, don't ask me to spell it.
Yeah.
Just write flow.
Yeah, if you go to Amazon and type in flow, you'll find it pretty quickly. It is a difficult book to read, though. It's
pretty technical, like how they did the study.
Yeah, it's pretty analytic, but the conclusions are pretty powerful. But not to diminish that, let's talk about that. Is right at the beginning, Jeff, as they come in. You want that incremental goal that they're targeting. And so across all curriculum, you want to be focusing on, you know, our focus would be is, now your first test is going to be for your gold belt. We want to have at least 16 classes by then. The next one is scheduled to, what is this, October? Let's say December 15th. So the next one is scheduled for December 15th. By December 15th, and by the way, let's put that in your calendar now. So December 15th, we have a graduation ceremony for that. Here's what we're going to want to have accomplished by then. And now, right at the beginning, they're focused on, see, because again, that'll be one of those things where you have it posted on the board and you think they all know, but they don't get it, right? And then 3 days before the test, you're saying, yeah, you're all set for your gold belt. What do you mean? Well, you know, that's your first belt. But see, I want to prep them for it. But I also want to have that short-term goal, right? It'd be like if you're in a weight loss clinic and the first goal is, you know, you weigh 150 now, we want to be at 147. Or you weigh 250 now, we want to be at 247. But to have that first incremental goal that's small and achievable and specific. So, again, I see a lot of curriculums where they miss that point, which is I'm just going to train and train and train and train. Well, here's that first progress update. And I don't want it to be more than 90 days out, right? So, but we, I mean, you know, in our case, there's already a date set. And if they started too close to the test, it's going to skip one. So it's going to be, you know, at this point is our target for gold belt. And it's in about, you know, 2 months, 3 weeks. The normal test cycle is 2 months. You actually have a little bit more time to make sure you've gotten in at least 16 classes. But we're going to target 21 classes by then. Is that making sense? And it's real important to focus on that short-term goal. And again, a lot of times for the adult programs, you miss that. So there's not the, you know, there's, if there is at all, it's okay, sometime next year you're going to test for something. That doesn't work. It's got to be, here's our next incremental progress check. And if you don't have a belt structure that fits with that, what you want to do is just give them a date and a target, and you're going to do a progress update, and you're going to go through their results to date, and by this date we want to have X number of classes, and build it into a system. Does that make sense? So, Al, what are you doing with their first progress check with Croft?
We do a 2-month workshop.
Yep.
Where we review all of the various techniques in level one. And then we advise them based on how far they've gotten into the system. And usually it'll be another 6 to 8 months before they actually take the test.
Right. But you're doing a 2-month progress update. Good, good. And again, if you have something like that where it's going to be 9 months before you take a test, you probably need to have 2 or 3 intermediate progress checks, right? So those are the equivalent of doing, you know, a mini test. So I mean, I could have a 12-month belt cycle if I wanted, but I need to do a 3-month and a 6-month and a 9-month progress check to make sure they're there. And if I can give them, you know, if I can get away with whatever you're doing, a stripe on the belt or a, you know, I prefer to have a different belt. So, you know, from a belt standpoint, you can have a brown stripe in the middle, a green stripe in the middle, a blue stripe in the middle, a white stripe in the middle if you need to subset it. What's the first, Travis, what's the first belt test you're putting the adult Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu suits?
Well, we do it every 2 months.
Every 2 months? Okay, good.
Yeah, we have like a stripe and then a belt, but they're all levels of white belt.
Okay.
Before the blue belt.
Okay.
We talked about before, there's a blue belt.
Yeah.
It takes a while.
Good.
And so I have a system set up, it's like levels of white belt leading to the blue.
Good, 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 good.
So you can still have integrity within whatever system you're training in, but yet set your curriculum up with the understanding that they need to have measurable, regular reinforcements that they know that they're doing it right. And it actually helps them learn it better on the way, too. You know, you're going to have a better blue belt or a better black belt. Yeah. But one of the errors we see a lot of times is, well, I made my testing cycle longer to accommodate the curriculum. No, just teach less stuff and then
right.
Do it in 2 months. If you don't want to give them a belt, call it something else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, double it, make it longer, make it. I mean, you know, but yet every couple months there's some sort of event or some action where they get feedback. And that's the big thing.
And if they're not wearing a belt, they can do shorts or T-shirts or rank insignia or something. And by the way, everybody remember, the Taekwondo guys weren't doing this stuff in the 60s, 70s either, right? All these different belt levels were more or less invented in the... Master Men, you have a better sense of history than I would, but I know... Jun Ri, when he came over here, was basically white belt, gold belt, brown belt, black belt.
They had 4 belts, and then they usually they just had like our first belt was a yellow belt, and you get a stripe, in the center, and then actually you had two forms in the yellow belt system. But now what Grant, the founder of our organization, he separated material from simple to complex, and he made his own system up,
mm-hmm.
and then he then he took some basic techniques in each of those, created his form, and got some sparring out of it, and went to the one steps, etc. But like what we do is for the first belt, they usually give children a sheet that they go do a good D sheet.
Mm-hmm.
Go home, and I,
yeah.
But Nat came up with that anyway. And they have to do five good D's, and they enter mm-hmm. that class. If they have a good class and behave, they get their belt. And then every so many lessons, we divide tips and three tips. They have to have three tips to be in 16 classes to be eligible to graduate. And basically, that's the form, their one steps, and then sometimes we do a little simple self defense and behavior and a life skill.
Yeah.
It's divided in three steps. You teach one of those at the tip, but they're a progress check about every two weeks to see how they're doing on that, and you give them a tip that they can do it.
How long was it in the old days, though? I think it was also.
Oh, with that.
How long was it between those belts in the old days? It was like a year, right?
And I guess the only point was, you know, from a business operation, a lot of our industry stole it all from the ballroom dance industry. And they were doing medals and ribbons and different things. And then an awful lot of this business structure was developed within Taekwondo and other traditional schools, but it was mostly adults. And it wasn't kids. And what a lot of the adult market people think is this is kids stuff. And really, it was stolen from adult ballroom dance industry, both with Arthur Murray and with Jack LaLanne. No, not Jack LaLanne. That was fitness. What was the other one?
Fred Astaire.
That's what I was trying to think of. There are three or four, but Fred Astaire and Arthur Murray specifically. So, it's just the principles that are important. And you've done a really good job with that, Travis, is taking the structure that's kind of externally dictated, but then intermediate chunking it, right? And as you talked about yesterday, I mean, you can always, if you have an organization or association, whether it's Tang Soo Do or the Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, the tournament sanctioning group is, what are they called again?
IBJJF.
If they have a certain dictate, you can always have the organization or the tournament belt, the organization or the tournament uniform, and then you can have the internal designations, and you just have to have the clear understanding of the matrix of how it works, right? We do that with black belts. We have a black belt with a white stripe, a black belt with a gold stripe, a black belt with a green stripe, black belt with a purple stripe, but when they go compete in an external tournament, they just wear their first degree black belt or their second degree black belt, so, you know, it's clear what it is, if that makes sense. Okay, so let's go back to the upgrade process, and see, I really don't exaggerate that this is the most important component of it. If you can take each new student and start them off smoothly, get them feeling a comfort level, get them feeling really, really good about what they're doing, not only does it fix the early dropout rate, but it fixes the upgrade rate. Okay, and the thing that doesn't work with renewals is, get me enrolled for 12 months, throw me over the wall to the instructor, and then go pull me out of class in 3 months and try to sell me a new program. That just doesn't work. One is, to some extent, there's almost an integrity gap to it, but most importantly, from a standpoint of the student, is you've set them to think in a certain way, and then you're trying to change the way they think about it, and that's a very difficult thing to do, and it's an inappropriate way to treat it. Does that make sense? So you really want it to be where, in this first conversation, I gave you the picture that this is the long-term outcome. And notice, I'm not talking anything about programs. I'm not talking about you really want to be in Black Belt Club, you really want to be in the Leadership Club, you really want to be in the leadership program. I'm not talking about any of that stuff. I'm really talking about your long-term objective with training and what you're trying to accomplish, right? And then I'm going to make sure that at the point of enrollment, whether it's the first lesson or the second lesson, that then I'm making a yet another appointment to really explain how things work, and I'm going to do the first 8 to 10 classes where it's scheduled by appointment. And what am I going to do? I'm going to do all the same stuff that I would do with an introductory class. I'm going to confirm them. I'm going to greet them at the door. I'm going to walk them through all of the things that are involved. And by the way, this is not that labor intensive. It sounds like it is, but it's just a matter of knowing ahead of time that these students are coming in about 10 or 15 minutes early because they're new and they're walking through the process, and I can have an instructor that's working with them, and it doesn't truly have to be one-on-one, but you don't want it to be 30, right? Is I want it to be a small, manageable number of 3 or 4 or 5 people so that I'm making eye contact and confirming that they've got it all done and they're under control. Does that make sense? So then what I'm doing is, through the process, I'm constantly talking about it, explaining not only long-term follow-up, but the steps that they have to take to qualify to train to Black Belt and Beyond, right? And in order to qualify to train to Black Belt and Beyond, they have to start doing their assignments. In order to, you know, commit to Black Belt and Beyond, they need to be making it consistently twice a week. And in order to, you know, commit to Black Belt and Beyond, they've got to have memorized the student creed and learned the different procedures and practices within the school and be congruent with that. Does that make sense? And so then that's going to walk them through the hand and introduce them to what it is that you're ultimately hoping that they're going to commit to for themselves. Does that make sense? Now, who benefits more from renewing somebody to Black Belt and Beyond? Is it you or is it the student? It better be the student, right? And so if you have a student that doesn't commit to train to Black Belt, what we know is they're going to do what? They're going to drop out. Do you truly believe that the quality and the substance of your program is such that if they stay with you to Black Belt, that is far more impactful and valuable than anything else they do? Okay, now if the answer is no, you need to go back and fix your program, right? But if the answer is yes, we're doing them a massive disservice, right? And think about your own training. Pretty much everybody in here is a black belt. If you go back and look at your own training, who benefited more, you or the instructor that was charging you money for it? I would hope all of us would say that, right? Yeah, I certainly know in my case, I got much more out of the training in martial arts than I ever paid anybody to train me. Right? And so, although it's a financial transaction, and although we are all personally getting psychic rewards and one thing or another for developing the students, truthfully, if we walk them down the path to get them to commit to Black Belt, it's a much bigger win for them, ultimately, than it is for us. Does that make sense?
Even though it was cheap back then, the money wasn't ever thought of.
Right.
At all. It was happy to give it away.
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't even thought of.
Yeah. Well, and certainly in retrospect.
Right.
You know, you don't say, oh, well, you know, I got my black belt for God's sake. I paid $5,000 to get here, and I don't know. Maybe it was worth $2,000. It wasn't worth $5,000.
Never.
Did anybody have that thought when they got their black belt? No. So, all right, you follow what I'm saying. And by the way, you've got to have that constant conversation with your staff. Because now what happens? If you're not careful, they get so fixated on the money that they think that you're doing these things in a manipulative way.
Sure.
Right? And if there's any manipulation here, it's in setting a student up to make the decision for what's going to be in their best interest. Right? And are there occasionally students that come in the school where we decide it's not in their best interest to train a black belt?
Sure.
I say occasionally there are, right? There's people with just the wrong attitude coming into this that we're not going to be able to fix. There's other things that are going on. And it always works against your interest to try to talk them into something financial that you shouldn't do, right? And again, you've got to be very clear with your staff. I've had a couple of my guys over the years who were making a lot of money, got very money motivated, and now they're trying to talk everybody into it. And so they're trying to figure out a way that this student who's going to be on, their contract's going to end in a year and they're going to move back to India, how they can get them to pay in full to black belt and what. No. It's got to be it's in their best interest. 100% in their best interest, right? Now, if it is in their best interest, then it's certainly the way that we're going to maximize our revenue and income as well, right? But again, so through that process, you've got to recognize that, right? And they don't come in knowing that, right? When do you know that martial arts was the best thing you possibly could have done for yourself? At the end.
When you were black and blue.
Right. At the end, looking back. So you know it at the end, looking back. So all this is designed to show them what the end, looking back, is early on so that they can make the right decision. Does that make sense? Yes, sir.
I have a question. Just summary. So you schedule an initial appointment, have them come back for the second, and then schedule 8 additional one-on-one group classes?
Yes, and well, now...
And each time you're explaining the expectations, their path, pre-framing the goal to black belt.
Yeah, now it doesn't have to be a series of private lessons.
Right.
But what I want to do is, number one, I want to know, written on their ID card, in your database, all that stuff, I want to know that your normal class schedule is going to be Monday at 6:15, Thursday at 7, whatever it might be. And so I want to know that going in. And part of the reason I want to know that going in is I want you to know going in what's your regular schedule. Because if you do this, here's the class schedule. As long as you come 2 days a week, come whenever you want, go for it. When do they come? I don't know. We're going to go on Monday, but something came up, and now we're going to go on Tuesday, and something came up. I mean, I got to tell you, I've got my 6-year-old in lessons, and I'm the worst damn martial arts parent you could possibly have. Because now something is always coming up, and then I'm here, or I'm somewhere else, and I'm a difficult one for them to pin down, right? But it's the same thing. You need to have the 2 set times that they're going to come in, and it's booked in the schedule, and it's in their iPhone, or it's in their Android, and it's written on the wall, and if it's a divorce situation, the ex-wife knows, and the ex-husband knows, and everybody, right? I mean, it's got to be one of those things. But now, okay, Ms. Jones, or Joe, your class is going to be on Monday, Thursday, and today is Wednesday, so is it going to work for your schedule to have your next class be tomorrow night? Sure. Okay, great. Well, I'm going to put you down for the class, which is at 7. What I'd like to do is go ahead and have you come in at 6:45. And at 6:45, we're going to walk through your ID card. We're going to walk through your student manual, your student notebook. We're going to walk through the basic processes and procedures to make sure that we're clear on everything. So now, what do you do? Same thing. I would call and confirm, put in the appointment book. Because guess what? Just because you signed the contract and did the thing, if you no-show for your third lesson, I've got a problem, right? So, and again, maybe it's, look, God, I didn't realize my wife had tickets for the concert, and, you know, we've got to do that. Can I make my next class on Monday? Absolutely. Keeping in mind with the schedule, you're welcome to use any other times as makeup. We do have a class Friday at this time, Saturday at this time. Would one of them work, or do you want to just get on a regular schedule next week? Yeah, let's do Saturday, right? So now you have that conversation. So now you've got them scheduled, let's say 15 minutes before the class, and I'm going to bring them in, walk them through, hold their hand. Some of it physical, a lot of it is procedural. Does that make sense? But I would do that at least for the first 8 classes, right? And when you don't just drop them, right? So don't do it for 2 classes, or don't do it for 8 classes and then just drop them. You say, well, you know, you're up and running with everything. Any questions about this? Any questions with this? I'm going to stop bugging you before each class time. You're on Monday, Thursday. However, I warn you that if you miss one, I'm going to bug you about it, right? So I'm not going to call you each time. But we want to be on this schedule. What I'd like to do is schedule another follow-up, right? So even at the end of the thing, don't just one day you stop doing it, right? You know, explain to them what the next step is. Questions or thoughts on that?
So you're saying for the first 8 classes for everybody, you're
given a pre-confirmation call?
Yeah. I mean, you can wean it off before that, but what I hate to see what we normally do is this, right? Whether you're doing a one lesson intro or two lesson intro, they call and you're all friendly and so forth. You give them directions, and then I have an appointment at 6, and I call and confirm it, and I send you a text, and I send you an email, and if it's far enough away, even drop you a little postcard in the mail. Then you come in, and what do? I greet you at the door. Oh, you must be Carol. Fantastic, great. Come on in, and then I work with you individually, and then I schedule your next appointment. Then what do? All the same stuff, and I greet you at the door, and then I bring you in, and you write me a check, and I give you an ID card, and then you're off in training. Right? And from a student perspective, how does that look? Oh, well, as long as I'm going to give you a check, you're all hot, you know, all on top of it. And as soon as I gave you a check, you dropped me like a cold potato. Right? You don't want that reaction. You want to wean them off of that a little bit. But from a self-interest standpoint, I'm going to be doing the confirmation, the follow-up, and zapping them a little email. And, you know, and we have that that renewal process online. But it's all designed to, okay, between now and next time, go look at milehighblackbelt.com. Go through week one. And it's designed to give them something else as a homework assignment. Obviously, if you've looked at it, the first 3 or 4 weeks is all about educating them how the program works. And the last 2 or 3 weeks is all about getting black belt and then how the programs work, right? So that's an additional resource that the franchise schools are using as introduce them to the program smoothly, right? And again, note that all that material is heavily weighted towards feedback, testimonial, other people saying what the program accomplished. Why? Just to prove that point. Does that make sense? Okay. Now when it comes to, and let's go back to your question, which is how to add the additional program on. So let's start with what you're doing now. What are your different levels?
Master's level.
Okay, well, you're doing an initial enrollment
Initial enrollment, yes, sir.
Is it a six-month enrollment? Or
1 year.
12 months,
okay. We call it basic introductory class.
Okay, good. Basic intro class. And then what's next?
Then master's class.
Okay. And what does master's mean?
It's just the second level up. It used to be our old black belt club, but we eliminated the black belt, turned it into a master's. But it's our first upgrade level. They get to do 4 different weapons. They get a lot of life skills.
Okay.
They get to come to extra classes if they want. And we have 15 minutes at the end of each class.
Okay.
Where they do weapons or sparring or whatever we're doing. They get to come to our goal meetings, which is guidance on leadership development.
Yeah.
And that's all the life skills.
Right. Okay. And how long is that enrollment?
3 years.
3 years, okay. Okay, and it sounds like the basic students and the master students are all basically coming to the same class, but then there's a tag at the end, right?
Yes, and then there's an extra class once a month for the masters to do a weapon.
Okay.
And then the life skills. But other than that, it's just 15 minutes extra each class.
Okay. Okay. Structurally, it's an extra 15.
How long are classes?
Most classes are half hour, and then they get an extra 15 minutes. My adult class is 45, and they get an extra 15 minutes. My Saturday morning is 45, and they get an extra 15. So our classes are pretty short.
Okay. But, okay, so that's the structure. And then what do you have as the next thing?
Leaders.
Okay.
Which I made pretty difficult. We only have about 10% of our people in leaders. You have to be a green belt. You have to have a B average. You have to go to events. So basically, they've been around for a while, and they're kind of a leader, or they're showing leadership characteristics in the school.
Okay. And they have to be green, which is what, 12 months?
1 year. Yeah.
Okay. So they have to be 12 months in to be considered for leaders. And if I'm a master's club, what do I get different once I'm in leaders?
Leaders gets an extra class once a month just for leaders.
Okay.
They get, and of course, they get to wear different uniforms. Leaders has a different uniform than the master. Leaders has a full uniform. Master just has a different top they wear.
Okay.
Leaders get to do every weapon you can imagine. They get to go to any of the events we have in the school, like the, you know, they get to go to the Qigong, they get to go to the Zumba, they get to go to the yoga, they get to the grappling class. They get to do anything extra.
Okay. And, of course, you're going to kill all that, so you got to integrate into the other curriculum. Okay. So they get to do all the extra crap. And how long is that enrollment?
3 years.
Is it the same 3 years, or is it extend 3 years?
Well, usually if they are in master's and then we sign them up for leaders, we just extend them another 3 years by the new agreement.
Okay, so I'm enrolled for 36 months, and then let's say at a year I go to leaders, it just, now it's 36 months, so it's essentially it added 12 months.
Yes.
Right? Okay. And what are you charging for now? What are you charging for basics?
I just went up.
Right.
167.
That's why I said now. Okay, so 167. And how about masters?
Oh, what did I just say? I was going up for that. I wrote it down. Hold on. I'll tell you. I think it's like 250 and then 3. I can't even remember what we just did go up though.
Okay.
I think it's going to be like 340. Okay, here it is. No, that's the only. Okay, here it is. Sorry. I'm going to go to 149 every 2 weeks, so it's going to be 323 a month is going to be leaders. Masters are going to be 260, and my elite program, and you're going to kill me, I'm thinking 347 a month.
Yeah, that's really elite.
Yeah.
Okay. Is anybody else doing the billing every 2 weeks rather than once a month? Are you doing that?
Only if they request it. We don't offer it.
Well, yeah, that's different. That's different. They say, well, I can't really afford $500 once a month, but can I do it every 2 weeks? Or it's a divorce situation, and the mom wants to pay half on the 1st, and the dad wants to pay half on the 15th. Or, I mean, you have all those different iterations. But you're just signing everybody up immediately into the billing is 149 every 2 weeks rather than 323 a month. And so, therefore, every 2 weeks you get 26 billing cycles rather than 12 monthly cycles. And it actually is kind of buried at a little higher level. Anybody have any thoughts on that, plus or minus? That all came out of Australia, I think.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Go ahead.
It seems like double the work, you know, the accounting work.
Well, it should all be automated anyway, so I'm not worried about that. It's easy enough in any of the software systems, or I imagine, I haven't asked them about it, but Member Solutions, ASF, EFC, I'm sure they can all do that.
They all do it.
Yeah.
It's easy. Some people think it can mislead people because on some months you have a third billing.
Yeah.
So we have to be very, very clear with it. But I like it because we have a lot of military families and a lot of families that could pay twice a month and they like kind of the every other week thing. And it gives me a whole month extra a year. I mean, I get an extra, basically, whatever my billing check is, an extra $25,000 a year. I mean, because it's monthly. I mean, because every 2 weeks.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, literally that's right. You're in. I mean, it all depends on what you're setting the tuition point to be, right? But the different, if it, let's see, 149 times 2 is 297, or 298. So if you were saying it's 298 versus 149 every 2 weeks, in reality you're collecting 13 months. Or said another way, you're bumping that by, 112, so you're really, instead of collecting 149, you're collecting about 159, I guess it would be. Anybody have any thoughts about that? I'm real ambivalent about it either way. I neither like nor dislike it.
Are there any data that suggests your decline or rejected rates lower?
That's the problem, though. You can't do a test. If you did half your school that way and half your school the other way, let me kind of figure out if there was a difference in, like, you know, like, for, I would be interested in that, because if I did $200 every other week, then I get $400 a month, you know. I would think that the is the sticker shock more if you show double price or if it's less? And I would guess it would be better that way, but I don't know that we really know. And
I did both, though. I started originally just doing monthly billing. And then I went and I heard this guy at a NAPMA thing, and I said, well, I'll try it. I thought about it for a while. I was afraid. I tried it, and I loved it. The people actually was easy for me, for us. It was a lot of our people are lower income, and it was an easier sale to make because psychologically they're thinking 120 times 2, 240, I can do that. Or
see, I don't think it's the lower income thing, whether or not it's lower income or not. If it's psychologically, if that was a psychological advantage, it'd be a psychological advantage either way. It wouldn't matter whether they're lower income or not.
I think it is. I personally think it is.
I think I agree with you. You know, the Center MMA, that was their presentation, is they were presenting that, I mean, and they got stupid prices, but, you know, it's $27 every 2 weeks or something like that. But then in reality, they were flipping it back around and billing you $57 once a month.
So they presented it as every other week.
But then when they actually set up the billing, they didn't bill it that way. I don't understand why you would...
I mean, Jan, what would be the argument against doing it every week, though?
Why don't
you
just
do it every week?
Because most people get paid
every
two, right?
Well,
yeah, a lot of our people do get paid. Military is twice a month.
Yeah, see, that's the... See, that's
the shot for class, because then it makes the math easy in your head. If your guys are sitting there going, well, that's $18 a class because you make the math easy for them, it might be a harder sell. Because, you know, I don't know if we say if our customers are really dialing it down to... It's, and we know ours is on average, you know, $18 a class because we train our staff that they better be teaching $18 worth of stuff to them. But
in Australia, New Zealand, that's pretty common. In Australia, New Zealand, it's pretty common that you're getting, you know, it's every fortnight or whatever. Here, it's pretty common that it's 1st and 15th you're getting paid. You know, if you're getting paid twice a week or you're getting paid weekly. You know, the lower down the economic scale you go, the more it tends towards you getting paid weekly or every other week rather than monthly, right? So when you're dealing with people who are lower income, having a weekly billing or an every other week billing makes sense to them. I'm not sure I have an opinion one way or the other.
That helps with people's mortgage payments.
Yeah.
They usually come on the first of the month, so you divvy it up to two times a month. It's not as big of a shock to them because that big chunk of the mortgage comes out of that one check, and they're looking at it like I have less to work with until my next check.
Except when the billing comes. Yeah. The only thing I don't necessarily like is every month the billing is going to be on a different day, right? So
we have set it's every other Monday, and we tell them we give them a schedule. It's not any problems. I love it. Personally, I love it. I'm
first
surprised.
I ever heard about it myself.
Yeah, it's you'll get an extra month. You'll get an extra month in your billing cycle for doing it. And the people, it's not that they don't realize it, but they just take in their mind 75 times 2, 150 a month. Well, it's not 150 a month. It's 162 a month or whatever.
It's the same thing when you see the pitches of, you know, pay off your mortgage in half the time or whatever. That's all they're doing.
Sure.
Is they're changing it from a monthly billing to an every 2 week billing. And now it's in a mortgage case, in a declining balance case, it has a more dramatic impact. Because you're paying more on principal, and therefore it's rapidly accelerating the because you're going to have the same amount of interest,
sure.
But you're paying more on principal, so therefore it rapidly accelerates it. I don't know. It's worth. I think it's worth thinking about. I don't like I've got the full schedule and I give it to them. It's not that complicated. If I have somebody who pays the first and gets paid the first and 15. I've heard the objection a lot. Can I have it on the middle of the month, not the first of the month, because I pay my mortgage and everything then? I've heard that one a lot. I do agree as you go down the economic scale, they're more likely to get paid weekly than like once a month. And as you go down the economic scale, they're much less likely to be capable of putting the money aside week one, week two, week three in order to pay it week four, right? So, from a standpoint of declines and stuff, the lower the payment is, the better you're going to be. I mean, I used to with coaching at a grand a month. I did it twice a month. I did two billings a month. And I first started doing it because a lot of people were paying with debit cards that didn't have that big a daily, you know, a one-time limit. And it helped with declines. Rather than trying to hit them for a grand, it was hitting them for 500 or it was hitting them for 250 a week. I ran this one by Bill Glazier and Dan Kennedy a few years ago, and their thinking was the exact opposite. Is they wanted to not have any of their clients have more than one charge a month, and in fact, for a lot of things, they were billing it six times a year. So they were billing every other month, and were pretty adamant, because I was talking about why I have a lot of them that are set up to bill weekly, and they were pretty adamant about the more times you show up on the credit card bill, right? And a lot of it in their case was the more times the wife sees the credit card bill of what the husband's spending. In this case, it's the opposite, right? The more times the husband sees the credit card bill for what the wife committed to. So I don't know. I mean, I had that argument with them. I never really came to a conclusion.
They have a different clientele, though, than what I would have. They are much higher end, I would
think. No, they're not. No, they're not.
For their mentoring group you're talking about?
No, they were talking about for their general membership base. I was amazed one time. I went to one of the wealth seminars, and he actually had that on the questionnaire and asked everybody, and the median income in the room was maybe 55, 60. I was shocked, you know, because I was back in the back of the Platinum group, and some of those guys were doing that a week, you know. But, you know, it their general membership isn't, you know. It's an awful lot of wannabes and an awful lot of, you know, I want to sell my book or something like that. And, you know, we have a fair number of NAPLA members who are members of theirs who, you know, like they've been members of theirs for 4 years trying to come up with something that they're going to do and aren't making any money doing it, but they're very rabid, enthusiastic, you know, wannabes. So anyway, that's the structure. And, Jan, your question was how do you create the next new thing, right? And how long does it take to get a black belt?
4.5 years.
4.5 years. So why are you doing a 36 month?
That's as long as I can go in Florida, from what I understand.
Have you read the law?
No, I've just been told that by the billing company.
By which one?
I think Member Solutions.
Is that the longest that the billing company will accept? Or no. Is that just what they advise you?
I think they advised me. They said, I'm pretty sure they said the longest we can go was 3 years in Florida. I think that's what Bill Clark does, too. Because he's right down the road.
Well, let's forget that's what who does or whatever. I grimace because I've had a couple of knockdown, drag-out fights with ASF over this topic. And what ASF will do, and I'm not saying Member Solutions is doing the same thing. ASF is predominantly in the fitness industry. So they'll read all of the fitness law in the country and automatically say that it applies to a martial arts school. And my argument in Colorado is that it doesn't apply to a martial arts school. And there are similar laws in Colorado that for 30 years now,